Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, The Paradise Snare, Book One of the Han Solo Trilogy by A.C. Crispin. Ancient Shroop ship, a relic of the Clone Wars, hung in orbit over the planet Corellia, silent and seemingly derelict. Looks were deceiving, however. The old Liberator-class vessel, once called Guardian of the Republic, now had a new life as Traitor's Luck. The interior had been gutted and refitted with a motley assortment of living environments, and now contained nearly 100 sentient beings, many of them humanoid. At the moment, only a few of them were awake, since it was the middle of the sleep cycle. Garrus Shrike, leader of the loosely allied trading clan that lived aboard the Luck, was not a man to cross without a good reason and a fully charged blaster. A slender man of medium height, Garrus was handsome in a hard-edged way. Streaks of silver white above his temples accentuated his black hair and ice-blue eyes. His mouth was thin-lipped. He seldom smiled, and never with good humor. At the moment, Shrike was sitting around the table in the former wardroom of the enlisted officers, playing sabacc and drinking tankards of potent Alderaanian ale. One of his fellow players, Brayford, a hulking Eloman with two bulbous eyes protruding from the sides of his head, suddenly glanced behind him. Brayford grunted.
"Something funny about the lockout sensor on the weapons cache, Captain. It's reading normal now, but something flickered as though the lock shorted out for a second. Probably just a momentary power flux."
The captain rose and walked around the table to study the readouts himself. "Somebody shorted out the lock and is running a sim to fool us into thinking it's just a power flux. We've got a thief aboard." He turned to a tall, heavy-set human. "Lared, activate the biosensor. See if you can ID the thief and where he's heading." Lared, Shrike's brother, nodded and bent over the auxiliary control board. "Corellian human," he announced after a moment. "Male. Height, 1.8 meters. Dark hair and eyes. The bioscanner says it recognizes him. He's heading aft, toward the galley." Shrike's expression hardened until his eyes were as cold and blue as the glaciers on Hoth. The Solo kid. He's the only one cocky enough to try something like this. Han Solo gripped the stolen blaster as he tiptoed along the narrow metal corridor. When he'd wired into the sim and jimmied the lock into the weapons cache, he'd only had a moment to grab the first weapon that came to hand. Nervously, he pushed strands of hair back from his forehead. The blaster felt heavy and awkward in his hand. Han had seldom held one before, and he'd never actually fired a weapon. He crept up to the door of the galley and hesitated. He heard the soft clatter of metal pans, then the splooch of dough being kneaded. Sticking the blaster into his belt, he opened the door and stepped into the galley.
"Hey, Dulana. It's me. I've come to say goodbye."
The Wookiee, who had been vigorously kneading the wastrel dough, swung around to face him. Dulana's real name was Dulana Mapia, and she had been Han's closest friend since she'd come to live aboard Traitor's Luck nearly 10 years ago, when he had been about 9. Shrike had found Han when he was 5 years old, homeless and begging in an alley, and put him to work with the other charges aboard the Luck. Each child aboard Trader's Luck was given an elementary-level education so he, she, or it could learn to count money. Beyond that, Shrike discouraged the children from pursuing higher learning. Partly because he wanted to flout Shrike's wishes, and partly due to Dulana's encouragement, Han had kept up his studies in secret. Once Dulana discovered what he was doing, she monitored his curriculum, making him study subjects he would have otherwise skipped. Reluctantly, Han tackled reading, math, the physical sciences, and history. Han couldn't speak Wookiee, but he understood it very well. For her part, Dulana couldn't speak Basic, but she understood it as well as she did her own language. So communication between the human youth and the elderly Wookiee widow was fluent, but different. Han nodded. "Yes, tonight's the night. I'm getting off Trader's Luck, and I'm never coming back. Even as Dulana rumbled at him worriedly, she automatically resumed kneading her dough. Han gave her a lopsided grin. You worry too much, Dulana. Of course I've got it all planned. I'm heading for Yalicia. There's a robot freighter headed there. It's a religious colony near Hutt Space, and they offer pilgrim sanctuary. I'll be safe from Shrike there, and... He held up a small holodisk. Look at this! They're advertising for a pilot! Impulsively, the Corellian youth threw himself against her warm, solid bulk, hugging her fiercely. I'm gonna miss you, too. You take care of yourself, Dulana.
Well, ain't this a touching sight? Said a cold, all-too-familiar voice. Han and Dulana wheeled to face the man who'd entered. Garrus Shrike lounged in the doorway. Larid Shrike and Brayford the Elaman were visible over Shrike's shoulder. Han licked dry lips. Listen, Captain, I can explain. Shrike drew himself up, his eyes narrowing. You can explain what, you cowardly little traitor? Stealing from your family? Stabbing your benefactor in the back? But I've had it with you, Solo. I've been lenient with you so far because you're a blasted good swoop pilot and all that prize money came in handy. But my patience is at an end. Han gulped with terror as Shrike started toward him. He'd lashed out at the traitor captain once before, 2 years ago, when he'd been feeling cocky after winning the gladiatorial free-for-all on Jubilar, and had been instantly sorry. With a snarl, Dulana stepped forward. Shrike's hand dropped to his blaster. You stay out of this, old Wookiee. Your cooking isn't that good. Han had already grabbed his friend's furry arm and was forcibly holding her back. Dulana, no! She shook off Han's hold as easily as she would have waved off an annoying insect and continued heading toward Shrike. The captain drew his blaster. Han leapt forward. No! His foot lashed out in an old street-fighting technique. His instep impacted solidly with Shrike's breastbone. The captain's breath went out in a great hoof, and he went over backward. Han hit the deck and rolled. A tingler boat sizzled past his ear. As Dulana started toward him, the captain wheezed, Larid! Shrike's brother drew his blaster and pointed it at the Wookiee. Stop, Dulana! His words had no more effect than Han's. Dulana was in full Wookiee battle rage. She grabbed Larid's wrist and yanked, spinning him around and snapping him in a terrible parody of a child's snap-the-whip game. Han heard a crunch as tendons and ligaments gave way. Larid Shrike shrieked. Grabbing the blaster from his belt, Han snapped off a shot at the Elaman who was leaping forward. Tingler aimed at Dulana's midsection. Brayford howled in agony and dropped to the floor. Shrike staggered to his feet, blaster aimed squarely at Han's head. Stop it, Dulana, or your buddy Solo dies. Han dropped his blaster and put his hands up in a gesture of surrender. Dulana stopped in her tracks, growling softly. Then she shoved Han aside and leapt for Shrike. The blaster's energy beam caught her full in the chest and she went down. Dulana! Han yelled in anguish. With a quickness he hadn't known he possessed, he dived at Shrike, hitting the captain in a driving tackle around his knees. Shrike went over backward again, and this time his head impacted solidly with the deck. He sagged, out cold. Han crawled back to his friend, turning her over gently, seeing the great hole the blaster beam had bored into her chest. He knew immediately that the wound was mortal. Han clutched her. No, I won't leave you. Tears blurred his vision. I don't care if I get away. Yeah, I'm sure you'll be safe. One with the life power. Han tried to sound sincere. He knew that some Wookiees believed in a unifying power that bound all of existence together. He'd never been able to translate the term accurately. The Wookiee word could have meant strength or force. Personally, he thought it was just superstition. Finally, Han gave way to her pleas. I promise. I'll go now. And I swear I'll always remember you, Dulana. He laid her gently on the deck, then rose and picked up the blaster. His running feet resounded through the corridors of Trader's Luck. The time for stealth was past. He had to reach the docking bay and that robot Yalician freighter. He skidded around the final turn and grabbed the spacesuit he'd hidden behind some fueling equipment. He could hear the sounds of pursuit now, but nobody would guess he'd be crazy enough to try stowing away on a robot freighter. At least that's what he was counting on. The airlock hissed open. Han leapt inside, closed the hatch, and began yanking on the spacesuit. He checked the air storage. Full. Good. He'd planned to bring along some extra air packs, but he didn't dare venture back out. The freighter was crowded with equipment and cargo, and the corridors were very narrow. The Dream wasn't constructed to accommodate a living crew, and Han had to turn sideways to squeeze into the bridge, where he froze. What in the name of all the sons of Barab is an astromech droid doing on the bridge, he thought. Everyone knew an astromech couldn't pilot a ship by itself. The Dream shuddered. Quickly, Han edged away from the bridge and headed back toward the cargo area. Finally, he found what he was looking for, and just in time. A small space, just the right size to allow him to brace himself with his arms and legs. Wham! Han's body jerked, then he braced himself against the thrust of violent acceleration. The Dream was undocked and away. Han Solo took a long, deep breath of canned spacesuit air.
Hey, Dulana, I'm on my way. I'm going to Elysia, and I'm going to become a pilot. I'll learn enough and earn enough to apply for the Academy the way we always dreamed. I'm free. We're safe. And Troy can't touch either of us now.
When Han awoke from exhausted sleep, he was completely disoriented at first. Then memory came rushing back in swift, violent images. Han's mind drifted back in time, remembering Dulana sadly. Then his mind wandered back to even earlier days when Shrike had first taken him aboard the Luck. Han stirred and shook his head. I should never have gone with him that day, he thought. If I hadn't gone with him, Dulana would still be alive. But if he hadn't gone with Shrike, he'd probably have awakened some night in the alley to find that Vreltz had chewed his ears and nose off the way they had one of the other alley urchins that Garrus Shrike had rescued. Han smiled grimly. Captain Shrike didn't have an altruistic bone in his body. He collected children and used them to turn a profit. At almost every planet the Luck visited, Shrike loaded up a group of his rescuees and took them down to the streets in the shuttle. There he left them under the supervision of a droid he'd specially programmed, F8GN. HGN assigned them to their territories and kept track of their proceeds as the children roamed the streets, begging and pickpocketing. Han could still hear HGN saying,
"Now, dear children, have you all got your territory assignments?"
The copper-colored droid swiveled its head a little rustily on its pipe-stem neck, regarding the 8 children from Trader's Luck as they stood ranged before it. All of the children, including 5-year-old Han, affirmed that they did, indeed, have their territories.
"Very well, then, dear children. Let me now give you your job assignments. Padra?"
The droid looked down at a small boy only a year or so older than Han.
"Today we're going to give you your first chance to show us how helpful you can be to these poor citizens who are burdened with credit vouchers, jewelry, and expensive private comlinks."
The droid's eyes glittered eerily. They were different colors. One had burned out long ago, and Shrike had replaced it with a lens scavenged from a junked droid, giving F8GN one red eye and one green.
"Are you willing to help out these poor, benighted citizens, Padra?"
"Sure am,"
the boy cried. He gave Han and the other small children a triumphant glance.
"No more baby begging for me!"
Han had felt a stir of envy. It was far easier to meet 8GN's quota for a day's work picking pockets than it was by begging. Pickpocketing, that was the way to earn big money. If you refused to work for Shrike by begging or stealing, you didn't eat. Han had no other skills to offer. He was too little to pilot, not strong enough to load smuggled cargo.
"But I won't always be,"
he had reminded himself.
"Soon I'm going to be big, and just 5 more years I'll be 10, and then maybe I'll be big enough to pilot."
Once he'd confided his dream to one of the other children, and the little Vrelt blabbed it to everyone. Shrike and the others laughed at Han for weeks, calling him Captain Han of the Imperial Navy. Han didn't know how he happened to be in that alley when Shrike found him. He didn't know if he'd been abandoned by his parents or if they'd died. The captain kept telling him that if he was good, if he worked and begged hard, if he earned enough credit, someday Shrike would tell him the secrets behind how he'd come to be wandering the streets of Corellia that day. Now, hauling himself up out of his cubbyhole, the young pilot made his way through the cramped passageways until he reached the bridge. The astromech droid was still there, its lights flashing away. It was a relatively new R2 unit, still shiny bright silver and green with a clear dome atop its head. It was hooked into the ship's robot controls by means of a cable. The droid must have been equipped with a motion sensor because it swiveled its domed head toward Han as he clumped boldly onto the bridge in his spacesuit. Han activated his suit communicator. Hey, you. Han cursed. What am I going to do now? If only you had a basic speech module. The droid answered in a matter-of-fact voice. But I do, sir. There was a pause. I regret, sir, that you are guilty of unauthorized entry, sir. I know that. I hitched a ride on this ship. I beg your pardon. This unit does not understand the term used, sir. Han called the R2 unit an uncomplimentary name. I beg your pardon. This unit does not understand... Shut up! Han bellowed. The R2 unit was silent. Han took a very deep breath. Okay, R2, I am a stowaway. Is that word in your memory banks? Yes, it is, sir. Good. I stowed away aboard this ship because I needed a ride to Yalicia. Now I'd like to check on our flight path, speed, and ETA to Yalicia. Please display that information. I regret, sir, that I am not authorized to give you that information. Han struggled to keep his voice calm. Listen carefully, R2. Don't you have some kind of operating systems program that orders you to attempt to preserve the lives of intelligent beings whenever you can? Yes, sir, that programming is included with all astromech droids. That fit in with what Han knew about astromech programming. Listen to me, R2. If you don't show me our flight path, speed, and ETA, you may be responsible for my death from lack of air. Do you understand me now? It whirred once, then said, I will comply with your request, sir. As Han studied the figures and diagram that appeared on the screen, he felt his uneasiness grow into real fear. Yalician Dream's flight path had been set to take it on a circuitous route to the planet in order to avoid the worst of the pirate-infested areas of Hutt space, and the little freighter's speed was set far lower than the ship was capable of. Not good. Not good at all. Han turned back to the R2 unit. Listen, if I don't alter our course and speed, I won't have sufficient air to make the trip. I'll die, and it'll be your fault. The R2 unit's lights flashed as the machine contemplated this revelation. Sir, my programming is in conflict with my hardware. I am constrained from assisting you. Han took one huge stride over to the droid and pounded his fist on top of the clear dome. Blast you! I'll die! Tell me! I have been fitted with a restraining bolt, sir. It prevents me from complying with your request. Han seized on this bit of information with alacrity. After a moment, he spotted the restraining bolt low down on the droid's metal carapace. He grasped it and tugged. The bolt didn't move. Suddenly, he remembered the blaster. Shooting a blaster inside a spaceship, even an unpressurized spaceship, wasn't a good idea, but Han was desperate. He examined the settings. Lowest setting, he thought. Narrowest beam. Aiming and narrowing his eyes, he squeezed delicately. A flash of energy erupted, and the little droid responded so shrilly it sounded like a scream. The restraining bolt fell to the deck, leaving behind a black burn on the otherwise shining metal of the R2 unit. Han inspected his work with satisfaction. Gotcha. Now, R2, be good enough to point me toward the manual interfaces and controls in your ship here. Following the droid's instructions, he wrenched off the top of the featureless control panel and studied the tiny bank of controls. Cursing at the awkwardness of trying to manipulate the controls while wearing spacesuit gloves, Han disengaged the hyperdrive. Once they were back in normal space, he painstakingly computed a new course, using the R2 unit to perform the more esoteric calculations for the jump that would send them back into hyperspace. You realize, sir, said the droid, that you will now have to land this craft manually. Altering our course and speed has invalidated the existing landing protocols programmed into the ship. Han leaned wearily back against the console. Yeah, I know. But there's no other way. I just hope I can work the controls fast enough to land us. Han sighed and closed his eyes. Dulana's loss was like a knife wound. No matter how he tried, he couldn't get away from the pain and the memories. He owed her his life. She had stood up to Shrike and insisted on taking him to a doctor when he had had a severe case of Corellian Tanaman fever. He even owed her his true identity. Until he was 11 years old, his only name had been Han.
Han often wondered about his last name. One night, when Shrike was drunk and in a good mood over his Sabacc winnings, Dulana casually asked him about Han's identity, and the captain had said his name was Solo. From then on, Han took every opportunity to try to trace his family. Every so often, Shrike would run a major scam on rich folks on Corellia. Han had been part of the background during several cons. Shrike would rent a wealthy estate on Corellia and then set up a family unit to provide a respectable backdrop to the scam. Han and the other children detailed to such a family would live on the estate and go to a rich kid's school. One of his jobs was to make friends with the children of the wealthy and bring them home to play. Several times this had resulted in valuable contacts whose parents had been duped into investing in Garrus Shrike's current scam. Shrike recruited Han frequently for his scam operations, partly because of the boy's easygoing charm and winning smile, and partly because Han's clandestine studies made him fit into his grade level better than most of the other children. Han had also gained a small reputation as an up-and-coming swoop and speeder pilot. On one of those visits, Han tracked down a family called Sal Solo and had met Thraken Sal Solo, a slightly older boy who closely resembled Han, conclusively establishing that they were related. Han had hoped to find a home with the Sal Solos, but the boy was a bully, and his widowed mother, Tion, was a fearful, untrusting recluse. However, Han did learn that he was probably the son of Tion's twin brother. The twins had been separated as infants when their parents, Han and Thraken's grandparents, had fled to escape from raiders. No one had heard from Tion's father or brother since. Thraken himself had notified Shrike of his cousin Han's whereabouts, and Han was returned to Trader's Luck and severely beaten. For a moment, Han wondered why it had never occurred to him to kill the unconscious Shrike before he'd made his getaway aboard the Elysian Dream. He'd have been doing the inhabitants of Trader's Luck a favor. He'd had the blaster in his hand. Han shook his head. He'd never shot anyone before yesterday, and killing an unconscious man just wasn't his style. But Han knew that if Garrus Shrike ever caught up with him in the future, he was a dead man. The captain never forgot, and he never forgave. He specialized in carrying grudges against anyone who had ever wronged him. Han got up to check their course and his air pack. Only a few hours' worth of air left now. He did some mental calculations while staring at the display. Close, he thought. It's going to be close. I'd better be ready to pop the cargo door on this crate as soon as we land. It's going to be very, very close. Although he'd flown hundreds of hours in swoops and speeders, Han's experience with piloting larger vessels was confined to the times Garrus Shrike had permitted him to pilot the Lux shuttle on easy runs. He'd never before tried to land anything as large as the robot freighter. The Elysian Dream headed down for the surface of a planet he couldn't even see. He glanced at the sensor readouts and the infrared scanners, though, and realized that Yalicia was a world of tempestuous air currents, even in the upper layers of the atmosphere. Mapping sensors created a global portrait of the planet. Shallow seas studded with islands and three small continents. The landing field was on the eastern continent. That must be where the colony of priests and religious pilgrims was located. The Dream rocked wildly, careening through the swirling air currents. Han forced the freighter into maneuvers only a swoop or military fighter could reasonably be expected to tackle. He realized he was gasping and wondered for a split second whether it was from stress and adrenaline or whether his air was running out. They were now only a kilometer above the surface of the planet, coming in with a rush. Too fast! Han slowed them, using the braking thrusters roughly. G-forces seized him, and he felt as though something were squeezing his chest in a giant fight. He was gasping steadily now, and he dared to look down at his air pack. Empty. The status indicator was solidly in the red zone. But they were almost slow enough now to land. Suddenly, the forward port side repulsor shorted out. The Dream yawed wildly to port, hit the ground, then bounced upward. The starboard repulsor blew, and then its entire starboard side impacted with the ground, nearly flipping the vessel over. Han was flung violently across the cabin. His helmet struck the bulkhead, and he lay there, arms and legs flung wide, dazed. He fought to stay conscious. If he passed out, he knew he'd never wake up again. The droid's mechanical tones sounded a bit shaken.
If you don't mind my saying so, sir, that
appears to have been a most unconventional landing. Han gasped for breath.
Open the cargo airlock!
When Han swam back up to full consciousness, he found he was in some kind of infirmary and staring into a face straight out of a nightmare. Only years of experience in dealing with non-humans of all varieties allowed him to control his initial reaction. The being's face was broad, with two bulbous, protruding eyes and covered with leathery, grayish-tan skin. No visible ears and only slits for nostrils. Above the nostril slits was a large, blunt horn that was nearly as long as Han's forearm. This creature's head was appended to a short, humped neck that was attached to a massive body. Then he noticed two undersized arms that were folded against its chest, half hidden by the loose folds of neck skin. The being's hands were delicate, almost feminine, with four long, supple fingers on each hand. The being spoke in accented but understandable basic.
"Greetings, Drago. Allow me to welcome you to Ulysha. Are you a pilgrim?"
Han's head was spinning. For a moment, the name didn't connect. "But I'm not..." Then things snapped into place. Vic Drago was the alias that appeared on all the ID he was carrying. Han had several alter egos, with proper documentation to back them up. Ironically, he had nothing by way of ID under his true name. He held his hand to his head.
"Sorry, I'm still kind of shaken up, I guess. No, I'm not a pilgrim. I came here to answer a job advertisement for a pilot."
"Excellent. Drago, I am the most exalted high priest of Ulysha, Tiruenza. Welcome to our colony. I am impressed, young human, that you managed to control and land a robot craft. Few human pilots have been able to react quickly enough to deal with this world's challenging weather patterns."
"Does that mean I get the job?"
"Would you be willing to sign a year's contract?"
Quickly, the contracts were produced, and Han signed them, then allowed a retinal scan as proof of his identity. Han hoped they'd just do a general, system-wide check of his retinal patterns. If the priests ordered a comprehensive all-system search, they'd discover that Vic Drago, Jaina Sedanian, Talus Bryn, Janel Andrus, and Keel Detana all shared the exact same retinal patterns. With all of the business details taken care of, Tiruenza then summoned an underpriest, or Sacredo as they were called, and instructed him to take Han on a tour of the complex. The Sacredo introduced himself as Veritil and led Han outside. Han was instantly bathed in sweat. Steaming heat and humidity smote him like a physical blow. The air was rich with smells. Heavy perfume from flowers, rotting vegetation, and another odor, one he'd smelled before but couldn't quite identify. Pools of water attested to recent torrential rain. Reddish mud made an arresting contrast to lush, blue-green vegetation. The flowers hanging from the vines and trees in the encroaching jungle were huge and multicolored, scarlet, deep purple, and vivid yellow.
"This is Colony One," Veritil explained. "We also have established a new colony for our pilgrims several kilometers from here."
Across from the Welcome Center, massive ship-dock droids worked on the Elysian Dream, repairing her repulsors. To Han's left, he could make out a large expanse of the reddish mud. Several beings of Tiruenza's and Veritil's species lolled in mud holes, tended by droids and servants of assorted species. Veritil waved a dainty hand in their direction.
"My people relish our mud baths."
"What are your people? Are you native to Ulysha?"
"No, we are native, or as native as our distant cousins, the Huts, to Nalhata. We are the Talanda Til."
Han resolved to learn the Talanda Til's language as soon as he could. Knowing a language that people didn't know you knew could often prove an asset. The priest waved at a massive two-story building on the far left.
"The multi-story buildings are where we process Ril, Andris, and Karsunum. The single-story buildings you see extend far underground in necessity for processing Glitterstim, which must be handled in complete darkness."
Han's nostrils flared.
Of course, that explained the odor. These were factories for processing spice.
He remembered that the Elysian Dream had originally carried a cargo of high-grade Glitterstim, the most expensive and exotic variety of spice. Veritil went on with his explanation.
We receive shipments of raw materials from Kessel, Ryloth, and Nalhutta several times a month. In the beginning, the robot freighters who supplied us landed here at Colony 1, but they could not negotiate our tricky atmosphere. So we built a space station and decided to use living pilots to ferry the raw spice material down to the factories. We used to have 3 pilots, but now we are down to 1. And the unfortunate Sulistan, who is currently serving as our pilot, has been ill. That is why we need you, Pilot Drago.
Hans saw figures entering and leaving the factory buildings. All wore tan-colored robes that came down below their knees and tan-colored caps that covered their hair. He gestured at the people. Factory workers? The Sacredo hesitated.
They are the pilgrims that have chosen to serve the oneness, the all, in our factories.
Oh, I see. He saw a lot of things now, and he had a bad feeling about what he was seeing. These pilgrims came here to attain religious sanctuary and wound up working in spice factories. I smell a vrelt, he thought. A dead one. The Elysian sun was far down in the sky by now, and throngs of workers were streaming toward a range of snow-capped mountains in the northeast. Veritil beckoned Han with one undersized hand.
It is time for the blessed pilgrims to attend devotions and to be exalted in the One. Render their prayers to the All. Let us take the path of oneness to reach the altar of promises. Come, Pilot Drago.
After a 20-minute walk, the group reached a large paved area that was fronted with a partially roofed structure supported by 3 monstrous pillars, which Veritil referred to as the Plain of Flowers. Hans saw several of the Talanda Til assembled beneath the pillars, including one that he tentatively identified as Teruenza. They were ranged around a low altar carved from some translucent white stone that seemed to glow with an inner light. The faithful filed into ranks and stood waiting. Hans stood at the back, shifting impatiently. The high priest raised his tiny arms and intoned a phrase in his native language. The sacredos, including Veritil, echoed him. Han leaned closer to the nearest pilgrim, a Twi'lek.
What are they saying?
The Twi'lek translated.
The One is all. The All is one. We are one. We belong to the All. In service to the All, everyone is exalted.
Finally, after nearly 15 minutes of chanting, Teruenza and all the priests stepped forward. The high priest pronounced,
"You have worked well. Prepare for the blessing of exaltation."
The crowd made a sound of such greedy anticipation that Han was taken aback. Moving in a great wave as though they were truly one, they dropped to the pavement and lay there, arms and legs huddled beneath their bodies. All of the priests raised their arms. Han watched as the loose, wrinkled skin that hung below their throats inflated with air and began to pulse. A low, throbbing hum, or was it a vibration, gradually filled the air. Han's eyes widened as he felt something invade his mind and body. It rolled across him in a great wave. Emotional warmth, physical pleasure, it was all of that and more. Han staggered back off the permacrete until he was brought up short by the trunk of a giant tree. He hung onto the tree physically and himself mentally, refusing to let himself be sucked under with that wave. Then, as quickly as it had started, the sensation was gone. He was free. But it was obvious the pilgrims weren't. Their bodies writhed on the stone, moaning with happiness and pleasure. Sickened, Han looked at the priests. They obviously weren't affected as the pilgrims were. So this is why these poor dupes stay, he thought. The next morning, when Han stepped out of the infirmary where he had spent the night, the first person he saw was Teruenza. Han nodded pleasantly to his employer. "Good morning, sir." The high priest inclined his massive head.
"And to you, Pilot Drago, allow me to present someone you are going to be spending a lot of time with during your employment with us."
The high priest beckoned, and Han heard someone behind him. His first impression was of height, and the second was of sharp teeth and knife-like claws. The felinoid being stood nearly 3 meters tall, taller even than a Wookiee. Its facial fur was black, but its whiskers and chest fur were white. A curved knife hung on its belt, and a holstered blaster was strapped to its thigh. Sleek muscles rippled everywhere. The newcomer grinned, bearing even more sharp teeth.
"Greetings."
Teruenza introduced the being.
"This is Merg. He's a Togorian. The Tagorian reputation for honesty and loyalty is unparalleled. We've assigned Merg to be your bodyguard, Pilot Drago. On planet or off, Merg will accompany you everywhere. Isn't that correct, Merg?
Merg has given word of honor,
the Tagorian affirmed.
The High Priest folded his undersized arms across his massive body, and his mouth curved up in what almost appeared to be a mocking smile.
Merg is going to make very sure, Pilot Drago, that no matter where you go or what you do, you will be safe.
Hans stared at the huge black-furred creature. Terowenz's meaning was unmistakable. Step out of line and Merg will rip you in two. Terowenzer went on.
Merg will show you where your quarters are. Tomorrow we'd like you to begin ferrying goods and personnel back and forth between the colonies.
After Terowenzer left, Merg took Han to the administration building and led him to a small suite consisting of a bedroom, refresher unit, and a small sitting room. But where will you sleep? Han asked. As expected, Merg indicated the sitting room.
Merg here.
Hans stared at the blaster in the Tagorian's holster. I had a blaster when I came here, but I don't know where it is now. I'll need to ask about getting it back. Merg flexed his fingers and the retractable claws popped out.
High Priest say pilot not need blaster.
Han told his bodyguard that he'd like to tour the factories, and they set off down a corridor of the administration building where restricted access signs were posted in many languages. Suddenly, Han glimpsed something large and grayish gliding far down the corridor. He squinted into the dimness. Hey, what was that? He started after it at a good clip. Merg made a futile grab for his charge, but Han was quicker than the big alien and dodged. When he reached the junction of the corridors, Han turned to stare up the one where he'd glimpsed that flicker of gliding motion. His eyes widened.
Hey, it is a hut, he thought. What's a hut doing here?
There was no mistaking that huge slug-like form reclining on its repulsor lift sled. As he hesitated, Merg pounced on him as though he were a vrelt, tucked him under one muscled arm, and ran back down the corridor. Then Merg set Han back on his feet and flexed a hand under the Corellian's nose.
My people teach everyone entitled to one mistake. Pilot just have his.
Han eyed the claws that gleamed under his nose, sharp and shiny as razors. Yeah, I can see your point. Or, rather, your points. Merg stared at the sharp, shining tips of his claws, then his muzzle lifted back from his fangs, and he made a low, mewling sound. For a moment, Han froze. Then he realized this was the alien's form of laughter. Evidently, Merg had caught the joke. Han managed a weak chuckle. So, how about we get some food, then check out those factories, eh, pal? He asked. While they ate, Merg told Han a little bit about his people. In Tagoria, males and females, though equal, did not mix their societies. Males lived a nomadic hunting existence, flying over the plains on their huge domesticated flying reptiles called Mozgoths. The females lived in cities and villages and developed all the people's technology. Merg sighed.
Tagorians, very emotional people, capable of great love, especially males. Great love is why Merg is here.
The huge alien looked so woeful that Han felt sorry for him. What's her name?
Mrav. Beautiful, beautiful Mrav. Must discover what happened to her.
Han took a sip of his Polanus ale. So, have you tracked her down?
Merg traced her from world to world to world. Merg lost her. Someone on Ord Mantell said he saw her board ship at spaceport. Merg check schedules, find out ship at many pilgrims on board. Merg take chance, come here. Priests say no Tagorians here. Merg not know where else to go.
Han shook his head. That's sad, pal. I hope you find her. Tough to lose people you love. After lunch, they headed down to the factories. Han sniffed the air, smelling the odor of the different spices mingling. The Rhodian guard on duty gave them badges and infrared goggles so they could see in the dark. Han beckoned Merg toward the turbo lift. Let's go all the way down and see the really good stuff. Privately, Han was wondering whether he might be able to light finger some of the tiny black vials. selling a little glitter stim on the side in a port city would increase his credit account by leaps and bounds. 6 floors down, the turbo lift ground to a halt. Han and Merk entered a large room with long tables lining the walls and filling the aisles. Each table was a workstation, where a worker sat or crouched according to his, her, or its individual anatomy. Han and Merk went to the supervisor, a furred Deveronian female, and identified themselves. The supervisor waved a sharp-nailed hand at the room.
My workers are the most skilled in the colony. They have to measure and trim the fiber strands so each dose will contain the correct amount of spice. It is essential, but very difficult, to line up the fibers so precisely that they will all activate at the same moment when exposed to visible light.
Hans stopped behind one of the human workers and watched in fascination as she separated threads of ebony-colored spice, aligning them with the utmost care. The threads curled around the worker's fingers, some of them as fine-spun as silk, but the tiny crystals made them incredibly sharp. One sharp-studded strand cut between the woman's forefinger and thumb. A thin line of blood welled from the deep gash. Han sucked in a breath. A few centimeters deeper, and the tendon in her thumb would have been severed. She muttered something in Basic, and freeing her hand, held it to stop the bleeding. Han froze as he heard her accent. This pilgrim was Corellian. She was bleeding profusely. He bent over her. You're hurt. Let me call the supervisor so she can fix you up. The girl, she was his age, possibly younger, started slightly, then looked up at him. No, please don't. If she sends me to the infirmary, I'll miss the exaltation. With a wry smile, she held out her hands. Her fingers, wrists, and forearms were crisscrossed with tiny slashes. Some were old and white and healed, but many were dark weals, still fresh and painful. As you can see, it happens all the time. Excuse me, but you're Corellian, aren't you? Han grinned. So are you. I'm Vic Drago, the new pilot. And you are? Her mouth tightened. I'm not really supposed to be talking. I better get back to work. Merk, who had been watching in silence, spoke up.
Worker is correct. Pilot must let worker return to work now.
The Corellian moved one step away but continued talking.
Okay, but what's your name?
She shook her head.
We give up our names when we leave all worldly things for the spiritual sanctuary of Yelisha.
Merk growled, showing his fangs. The woman's eyes opened wide in alarm.
I am Pilgrim 921.
Han discovered that the threads were packed in vials on the fifth floor, and he suggested casually to Merk that they visit that area next. When he reached that level, however, his heart sank. Four armed guards stood by the conveyor belt, watching the little vials prepared by the workers. Four guards? Han peered harder into the dimness. No, hold on a second. He saw a blur of movement, but couldn't discern anything for a long second. Then, as he focused his eyes, he made out oily, pebbled blackness barely visible against the black stone wall. But there were eyes in the midst of that blackness. Beady, reddish-orange eyes. Four of them. Then he saw two blasters, each strapped to a warty black thigh.
Era, he realized. Skin changers.
The Era were a lizard-like species that could change color to match the color of the background behind them. This ability made them very difficult to see, especially in darkness. Despite their clumsy appearance, they were fast on their feet. Han decided that he didn't want to tangle with them. He sighed. Scratch plan A. And there is no plan B, he thought glumly. Guess I'll just have to earn all my credits the honest way. The next day, Han took the Yelishan shuttle to check out the operation at Colony 2. He discovered that he really enjoyed piloting bigger ships. He managed to find a few extra minutes on his return run to Colony 1 to practice low-altitude flying, swooping the shuttle so low that the belly nearly brushed the tops of the jungle trees. Beside him in the co-pilot seat, Merk alternated between exhilaration and terror. When they returned, Veritil was waiting for them in the pouring rain.
The High Priest wishes to see you at once, Pilot Drager.
The Sacredo led the Corellian and his bodyguard to the High Priest's personal quarters, which occupied a large part of the underground level of the administration center. When Veritil keyed in the security bypass codes and they walked through the huge double doors into the High Priest's personal sanctum, Han couldn't repress a low whistle of amazement.
Nice place.
Thuratil looked around. The High Priest is very proud of his collection of rarities. Display tables, shelves, and racks showcase treasures and antiquities from around the galaxy. Sculpture from a dozen worlds, paintings, and other art objects were scattered amid ornate antique weapons. Tapestries hung from the walls. Rugs of exquisite beauty were covered by protective force fields that felt squishy underfoot as Han walked on them. Veritil led them through another security door into the High Priest's personal living quarters. The visitors were ushered into the room by an ancient Zizian majordomo, whom Terowenza addressed as Gunnar Toss. The Zizian was humanoid, but he had wrinkly green skin that hung in flaccid wattles from his receding chin line. His orange eyes were rheumy, and he snuffled constantly as though he had a sinus infection. The High Priest waved Han and Murg to seats.
So good of you to come, Pilot Drago. I hear good things about your piloting from colonies 2 and 3. Today our medical droid placed our other pilot, Jarlus Nebel, on indefinite sick leave, so you will be taking his place on interstellar flights from now on. Day after tomorrow you will rendezvous with a ship from Nalhutta at coordinates we will provide you with at the last minute. Security is vital, as I'm sure you can understand. We've had trouble with pirates in the past. Have you trained Murg as a gunner, pilot?
No, not yet, sir.
See that you do. A good pilot is prepared for all eventualities, correct?
Han nodded. Yes, sir. I'll see to it. Sir, what's the cargo?
You'll be carrying a load of processed carcinum and picking up a load of raw rill transshipped from Ryloth.
But the ship I'm meeting is from Nalhutta?
Yes.
Terowenza did not expand upon this, so Han dropped the subject, resolving to keep his ears open. The High Priest sat back on his massive haunches.
I gather you liked my display room?
Liked? Han was able to speak with complete honesty. I never saw so many treasures gathered together outside a museum. I'd really like to get a grand tour sometime. Terowenza spoke regretfully.
I wish my collection were in condition to be viewed. Gunnar Toss, though an excellent cook and an efficient houseboy, hasn't the training to maintain it, much less catalogue and arrange everything properly, and I am too busy to indulge myself that way.
Once outside, Han glanced at his chrono and then at the westering sun before turning to Murg. Tonight I'm going to start training you on gunner's duties, but right now I think we're owed a break. Matter of fact, we're just in time to visit the refectory where the pilgrims eat. Murg did not understand.
Pilot not want pilgrim food? Pilot and Murg eat in mess hall. Get decent food, not garbage.
Han shook his head and started walking down the path that led through the jungle to the pilgrims' area.
I don't want to eat with the pilgrims, pal. I just want to talk to some of them.
Murg nodded.
Ah, yes. Murg understand very well what Pilot wants.
Han felt his face grow hot and was glad that the Togorian wouldn't recognize that giveaway sign of embarrassment. He changed the subject deliberately.
You know, Murg, old pal, you speak pretty good basic, but there's one part of speech you ain't mastered yet, and that's the pronoun.
Never thought I'd find myself playing school teacher, but here goes. Seen in normal light, he could tell that she was tall and slender. Too slender, really. 921 had big blue-green eyes, long, dark lashes, and white skin. Several locks of short, curly hair had escaped from beneath her pilgrim's cap, and Han saw that it was reddish gold. She was poking at her dinner, and after one look at the unappetizing mess of gruel-like porridge, limp greens, and flatbread on her plate, he didn't blame her. Han's nose wrinkled as he pulled out the seat opposite her and sat down. He was dimly aware of Murg leaning against the wall, watching him. Han grinned at her. Hello. Found you again. She stared at him, then looked down at her plate. Please, go away. Her voice was barely above a whisper. I'm not supposed to be talking to you. You're not of the One.
Sure I am. I'm just a little bit more of an individual one, I guess you'd say.
921's mouth quirked, very slightly. Han found himself wishing he could make her really smile. He changed the subject to something she might be willing to talk about. It's a tough job working down there in the dark all day long. Wouldn't you rather do something a little easier? Like what? she asked. Well, I don't know. What are you good at? She spoke with a faint wistfulness. Well, at one time I wanted to be a curator in a museum. I was going to study archaeology. I knew quite a bit about that. But you came here instead. Yes, this life is spiritually fulfilling. My old life was empty and meaningless. When we are exalted, I feel very close to the One. When she had finished eating, Han walked her to the exaltation. This time he had little trouble resisting the effects of the event and remained clear-headed. Instead, he watched 921, saw her rapt face, and inwardly shook his head. How can she be taken in by this ridiculous bilge, he wondered. She's obviously intelligent. Why can't she see that however these priests do what they do, it's some kind of trick, not a divine gift? Han leaned forward in the pilot seat of the newly repaired and refitted Yelishan Dream, glancing at the figures rolling by on the screen of the navicomputer. Ready to enter real space at rendezvous coordinates. 3, 2, 1. Han pulled back the lever and the stars around the Dream elongated into thin streaks of light, all reaching toward a central point, a point toward which the ship plunged. He turned to Merg triumphantly. Right on course, Merg. I'm getting this interstellar flying stuff down pat lately, ain't I?
Aren't, the Togorian corrected. I have been reading book pilot gave m...
He stopped himself.
Me, and ain't is not correct way to talk basic.
Han scowled. Remind me to teach you about articles sometime. Don't I even get a gold star for bringing us to the rendezvous right on the money? The Elysian Dream shuddered violently as something slammed into her hull.
What the...
Han pushed buttons, turning on the rear view screen.
Two ships! They've got to be pirates! Get to the gunner's well!
As he stared at the screen, the rightmost vessel launched another shot.
Brace yourself!
Merg, who had unstrapped himself and gotten up the head for the gunner's mount, yowled as another shot whanged against the hull, sending him back into his seat with bruising force. Cursing, Han yanked the Dream hard to port. Who were these guys? Pirates usually fired warning shots and demanded that the attacked vessel surrender. Their goal was to steal the cargo, commandeer the ship, and keep the crew alive so they could be sold as slaves. Destroying or crippling the ship and killing the crew wasn't cost-effective.
Mern, get below! They're gonna blast us into atoms! We've lost the shield!
Han sent the ship into a desperate roll, flipping her up on her side just in time to avoid another blast that would have blown out his quad-X power core. He put on a burst of speed, trying to get far enough ahead of the pursuing pirates to double back and shoot at them. Having watched some of Merg's practice sessions on the gunnery simulator, Han had little confidence in Merg's ability to actually hit anything while manning the gunwale. Han sent the Dream spiraling down and back beneath the oncoming ships. As they whooshed by overhead, he flipped his vessel up into a tight turn.
Merg, now!
A Pythagorean roar and a splat of energy rewarded his command, but Merg missed his quarry completely. One of the pirates had turned and was firing again. The Yelishan Dream shook violently as the ship sustained a major hit. Han's stomach lurched as he heard a yowl of sheer agony float up from the gunwale.
Merg! Merg, are you hit?
There was no answer. All right, you creeps. Han homed in with his Arakid concussion missile, centering the rightmost pirate in the cross sight.
Take that!
A second later, a bright yellow-white light flashed out in all directions, expanding into a fireball of incandescent beauty. Han had to look away, and when he looked back, the other pirate was hightailing it in the opposite direction at full throttle. Han growled,
"No, you don't. I'll get you, too."
With a fierce stab of his finger, he tracked and launched again. The concussion missile followed its target, but the pirate ship had jumped to hyperspace and safety.
Seconds later, Han was standing in the ruins of the gun mount, surrounded by the pressure sealant that the dream systems had automatically triggered to mend the pressure leak. Murg was slumped, unconscious, in the movable seat. There was a burn mark just below his right ear. Han ran his fingers through the black fur and discovered a swelling lump just in back of the ear. Gotta get him to a medical facility, he thought. Where's the nearest system? Han scanned star charts, then his fingers stabbed down. Okay, here we go. Before long, the world he'd chosen was growing in his view screens. It was lovely, hanging blue and white and tan against the night blackness of space. His fingers clicked on the comm unit, and the vid screen filled with an image of a kindly-looking man with a little, dark-haired girl sitting on his lap. Han was startled, then realized that this message was pre-recorded and played to every ship on an approach vector. A voiceover identified the man.
His Majesty, Bail Prester Organa, Viceroy and First Chairman.
The man smiled into the screen.
Greetings. On behalf of myself and my people, I bid you welcome to Alderaan.
Han listened with half his attention as the man continued with the vid message.
As many of our visitors are already aware, Alderaan is a peaceful world, a world where we have eschewed weapons and their use. While you are our guest, we ask that you respect our traditions and our laws by leaving your weapons with the Port Authority during your stay here. You will find that Alderaan has much to offer visitors. We have almost no crime.
Right, Han thought. I'll just bet.
And no pollution. Our lakes are clear, our air is pure, and our people are happy. We have wonderful museums, and we invite you to visit them. Be sure not to miss our grass paintings as you fly over them on your landing approach. Our grass painters are among the greatest artists in the galaxy. We welcome visitors to our beautiful world, and we ask only that you come in peace and that you obey our...
With a muttered curse, Han leaned over and snapped the audio portion of the broadcast off. A whole planet full of honest citizens? I'll believe it when I see it. The capital city of Alderaan, Aldera, was located on an island in the middle of a lake. The site of the lake was actually a meteor crater that had filled with water from underground springs. The lake was surrounded by a series of low, jagged foothills whose sides were splashed with green fields and forests. The water filling the millennia-old crater sparkled brilliant ice blue in the early morning rays of the sun. The spaceport was on the far side of the island, and Han swooped low over the city on his assigned approach vector. In just minutes, he was bringing the Elysian Dream down for a perfect landing. A medical unit arrived promptly at Han's request and ran a preliminary scan on Murg.
There is no life-threatening trauma as a result of the head injury. However, we will need to run further tests.
Han watched the stretcher bearing the Togorian vanish into the transport, which then headed to the medical facility. He grinned to himself, thinking, "This is a piece of cake. All I have to do is tell the priests that I was boarded and the pirates took the Glitterstone. Murg was out cold. He doesn't know what happened. I can sell this spice here on Alderaan, stash the money in an account here, then send for it later." The metropolis glittered white in the sunshine, as clean and luxurious as a dream city. Han scanned the streets as he walked, looking for a particular type of individual. Finally, he spotted what he was looking for. A boy dressed in clothes that were borderline too small, ragged, and not very clean, was sauntering along the street, glancing oh so casually at each passerby. A pickpocket. 10 years ago, he'd been that kid. Han increased the length of his strides until he caught up with the boy. As expected, the lad shifted his weight and altered his stride to brush against Han. Also expected were the lightning-fast fingers that delved deep into the pilot's jacket pocket. The fingers came away empty. Han's ID and the few credits he was carrying were sealed into the inside pocket of his coverall. Han lengthened his strides until he was ahead of the boy. Then, without warning, he spun on his heel and confronted the child. "Hey there," he said pleasantly, holding up the boy's ident disc and money. "Lose something?" The boy's mouth dropped open in amazement. Then he recovered and glared at Han. Then he launched into a furious and detailed description of Han's ancestry, personal habits, and probable destination. Han listened patiently until the urchin began to sputter. Then he waved for silence. "I'll give him back in exchange for some information." The boy glared sullenly.
"What kind of information, you son of a diseased pervert?"
"Watch your mouth, Junior," I just want to know where in this town people go to make deals.
What kind of deals?
You know what kind of deals. Deals they don't want the law to know about? Deals for substances you can't buy legally?
Spice?
The boy frowned.
What kind?
Glitterstim. The boy's brow creased even deeper.
What's that?
Just my luck, Han thought. I run into the only dumb pickpocket in Aldera. What about Andrus? You got Andrus here? Used to flavor food, preserve it? The kid nodded.
Yeah, Andrus, we got that. Expensive stuff.
Right. If you or your friends wanted some, how would they get it? Buy it in a store or a government agency? The boy shook his head.
No, man. We'd buy it from Darak Lil.
Alderaanian taverns were much too clean and well-lit, Han decided, an hour later. He'd been to three so far, and none of them appeared seamy enough for his purposes. No sign of Darak Lil, either. Han finally ran down Lil in the fifth tavern he visited. He was playing sabak, and when he saw Han standing there watching the game, he cordially waved him over.
Care to sit in for a hand?
Han stared directly at Darak Lil and raised his eyebrows. All depends on what you'll accept for a stake, Lil. The man's expression didn't change a whit as he glanced casually up.
You got something good, pilot?
Might.
Well, the ante is 20 credits.
Han shook his head. Changed my mind. Going out to get some fresh air. He stood outside, leaning against the alley wall for about 5 minutes. Then someone approached him.
So, what have you got?
Han turned to look at the man.
Glitterstim. 100 vials.
Wow, where'd you come by that?
None of your business. Want it? Give you a good price. Lil sounded regretful.
Wish I could, young fella. Wish I could. But I'd be a fool to take it. Just no market here on Alderaan.
Han groaned.
What a world, he thought. So goody-goody that a guy can't even sell a perfectly good cargo of spice.
Murg was released from the medical center the next day, and they made an uneventful trip back to Yalicia. As soon as they landed, Han was summoned to meet with Terowenza. The minute the high priest saw Han, his expression, which Han was beginning to be able to read, turned positively benevolent.
Pilot Drago, I understand you are a hero. Your bravery and courage are beyond price, but I have ordered a bonus to be placed in your account.
Han blinked, then smiled. Thanks, sir. Terowenza continued.
We have lost 2 ships that failed to return from their rendezvous points over the past year and a half. You are the first pilot to get a look at your attackers and return to tell us who they were. What did you see?
The priests were extremely interested in all the details of the attack, and Han told the story as thoroughly as he could.
Well, it all happened real fast, but I'm pretty sure that the ship I destroyed was Drell-built.
Did they communicate with you? Give you a chance to surrender before attacking?
No, they shot first and just kept on shooting. They weren't trying to destroy the dream, because if they had been, they'd have done it. But they had no interest in the ship. These guys were out to cripple the dream and kill me and Murg. I think we need to strengthen the shielding, sir.
I will order that to be done, pilot.
The huge Talandatil folded his tiny arms, and his massive forehead wrinkled as he considered what Han had told him. They attacked just after we came out of hyperspace, like they were waiting for us. Sir, I'd like to ask a favor.
Yes?
My blaster was taken from me when I arrived on Yalicia. I'd like it returned. If there's any chance I might be boarded by pirates sometime in the future, I want to be able to shoot back. Terowenza nodded agreement.
I will order your weapon returned to you, pilot. You have certainly demonstrated your loyalty and earned our trust by your actions these last few days.
The priest waved a small hand.
Tell me, pilot Drago, did it never occur to you to attempt to sell your cargo and tell us it had been stolen by pirates?
Han shook his head. No, sir, it didn't. Han decided it was time to meet Jollis Nebel, the Sulistan pilot who was put on sick leave. Nebel was sitting in his room in the medical unit watching a galactic news documentary. Han walked over and offered his hand to the big-eyed, droopy-jowled being. Neville invited him to sit down.
I've been wishing to speak with you for some time, but I've been quite ill and confined to these few rooms where the air is specially filtered for me.
Han looked closely at him. That's too bad, pal. What happened? Overwork? The Sullustan's small, wet mouth pursed unhappily.
Too many missions, yes. Then one day I awoke and my hands...
He held out his delicate hands with their narrow, oval claw nails.
My hands would not stop trembling. I could no longer handle the controls of my ship. Too much hauling of Glitterstim. Medical droid says I have a bad allergy to it.
Han thought of how he'd feel if he couldn't fly anymore. Hey, pal, I'm really sorry. I hope you'll be better soon. He lowered his voice and switched to Trader's argot. Understand you, traitor talk, friend? The Sullustan nodded.
Not speak, but understand fine.
Han glanced up at the ceiling. Were the Yelishans or their security monitoring this room? No way to be sure, but he hadn't met too many droids who could translate Trader's argot because it was a bastardized mix of a dozen or more tongues and several dialects. He waved up the volume on the newscast, then mouthed, Friend pilot, when hands grow steady, then if me you, not say farewell, just fly off bad spice world, quick, quick. Understand? The Sullustan nodded. Han lowered the volume slightly, then told Neeble about the attack. How'd they find out those coordinates? Jealous Neeble sighed.
I believe that the Talanda Teal are worried that these pirate vessels may in fact be from Nalhutta. Hutt dispatched ships masquerading as pirates.
Han whistled softly. By all the minions of Zendor, that takes the cake. The Hutts are fighting against each other, but the Hutts are the ones who are running this place.
Ah, you saw Zaval then?
If that's the bloated son of a gun who rides around on that repulsor sled, I sure did. Haven't yet had the honor of meeting him face to face.
Pray you never do, Vic. Zaval, like most Hutts, is not easy to please. The Hutts and the Talanda Til, their caretakers, profit in two ways from Yelisha. First, there is the processed spice. But the Yelishan Hutts must buy their spice from other Hutt families who provide the raw materials. Have you ever heard of Gilliak or of Jabba?
Han frowned. Jabba the Hutt? Isn't he the guy who pretty much controls Nar Shaddaa, the smuggler's moon that orbits Nalhutta?
That's right. He divides his time between Nalhutta and a spice transshipping operation he runs through a back of beyond planet called Tatooine.
Tatooine? Never heard of it. Neeble shuddered.
Trust me, you don't want to go there. It's a dump.
I'll keep that in mind. So this Jabba and Gilliak get the raw spice and ship it here for processing, right?
Yes. But lately, I believe, they may be trying to increase their profit by sending out ships to masquerade as pirates and having them hijack the Elysian spice ships. That way, Jabba and Gilliak get the processed spice for nothing, something that would please them greatly.
Han nodded. What I'm figuring is that this whole setup on Yelisha is just one big scam to get their lousy spice processed cheap.
That is not their only motive, Vic. There is another way the priests profit from these colonies. They run slaves,
Neeble said bluntly.
The Yelishans export the pilgrims from the spice factories when they consider them fully trained, all will to resist removed. They are taken to other worlds and sold. Their places in the factories are filled by fresh shipments of pilgrims.
Han nodded grimly. And the slaves are too cowed and brainwashed to tell the truth.
Certainly. And even if they did talk, who listens to a slave?
Once outside, Han decided to try to catch up with 921 at evening devotions and have a few words with her. He had to figure out some way to get her out of that factory and yet keep her here on Yelisha until he could help her escape. He rounded a turn near the Plain of Flowers and nearly ran headlong into the first of the pilgrims on their way back from devotions. They were staggering or shambling along, that drugged, ecstatic look in their glazed eyes.
Han found 921 in the crowd and hurried up to her. Hi. She looked up at him in the twilight and said uncertainly, Hi, you've been gone for a while. Han took her arm and fell into step with her. Off-world, had some cargo to transport. There was a moment of silence before she spoke. How was your voyage, Vic? Han was pleased. It was the first time she'd betrayed any curiosity about his life. He picked his way down the muddy path.
Turned out okay. Pirates shot at me, though.
Pirates? She looked distressed. You could have been hurt. He smiled at her and shifted his grip so they were walking hand in hand. How nice to know you care. He took her hand and raised it to his lips. I missed you while I was away. You did? He couldn't tell whether the thought pleased or distressed her. Maybe both. Yeah, I thought about you. It occurred to Han that this was the first time he'd ever been this honest about his feelings with a girl. For once in his life, he wasn't putting on an act. I didn't want to, but I did. You do care, don't you? Just a little? I don't know. She tried to pull her hand away, but Han wouldn't let it go. He began to kiss her scarred, lacerated fingers. The touch of her skin against his mouth intoxicated him as much as Alderaanian ale. Stop that, please. Why? He turned her hand over so he could kiss her wrist. Don't you like it? Yes. No, I don't know. She yanked her hand back, and this time Han let it go, but stepped forward to catch her sleeve. Please. He held her with his eyes as much as with his hand. Please, don't go. Can't you tell that I care about you? He swallowed. A lot. She caught her breath, and it sounded like a sob. I'm not supposed to care. Han couldn't hide the touch of bitterness in his voice. You won't even tell me your name. She stood poised for flight like a bird, her eyes wide and tormented. It's Bria. Bria Theron. Then, without another word, she picked up the skirts of her robe and ran away. The next day, after long hours of thinking and planning during a mostly sleepless night, Han went in search of Terroenza. He found the High Priest and Veritil relaxing in the mud flats. The High Priest waved an undersized arm.
Our heroic pilot, please join us.
Climb into that muck on purpose, Han thought, repressing a grimace, but he understood that the Talanda Til were offering him a great honor. He sighed. He stripped to his shorts. Carefully, he placed his belt pouch atop the pile of clothes, with the open end facing the mud hole. Then, with a grimace that he tried to turn into a smile, he stepped off the bank. Red mud oozed up his legs. Veritil caught up a blob of mud and slathered Han's back.
Isn't this wonderful?
Han nodded vigorously. Yeah, great. Terroenza settled deeper into the wallow.
So, Pilot Drago, why did you wish to speak with me?
Han got as comfortable as possible. Well, sir, I think I may have solved the problem of how to take care of your collection. Terroenza's massive head swiveled on his almost non-existent neck.
Really? How?
I've made friends with one of the pilgrims, a young woman from my homeworld. Before she came here, she was studying to be a museum curator, and she knows a lot about caring for antiquities, collectibles, stuff like that. I'll bet she could catalog and care for the stuff in your collection.
And where does she work?
In the Glitterstim factory, sir. Terroenza turned to Veritil, and the two priests began talking in their own language. Turning back to Han, Veritil said,
This pilgrim, would you say she's attractive as your species measures attractiveness? For example, do you find her appealing as a potential sexual partner?
Deep in the mud, Han crossed his fingers. 921? Oh, no, sir, she's... Well, to be frank, sir, she's so ugly that if I had a pet with a face that homely, I'd make it walk backward. When they heard Han's words, both priests guffawed and slapped their arms across their chests, which was apparently their species' way of paying tribute to a witty turn of phrase.
Very good, Pilot Drago, Terroenza boomed. You are indeed a sharp fellow, and I shall investigate this young woman.
Han squirmed around in the mud until he was facing the Sacredo.
I've got something I'm curious about. Mind if I ask you a question?
Not at all, the younger priest said.
How do you guys do that thing with the pilgrims each night at the devotion? I've never been able to experience it.
To himself, he added silently, because I've fought it as hard as I can.
Veritil replied, that is because you are a strong-minded individual, Pilot Drago. Our pilgrims come to us because they are weak and looking for guidance.
Teruenza spoke up.
The exhortation is a refinement of an ability we males of the Talanda Til use to attract females during our mating season. We create a frequency resonance within the recipient's brain that stimulates the pleasure centers. The humming vibration is produced by air flowing over the cilia in our neck pouches when we inflate them. Our females find it irresistible.
Veritil added, we males also have a low-grade empathic projection ability. By concentrating on feeling good, we can project those feelings at the crowd of pilgrims. Both effects, taken together, produce the exaltation.
Khan shook his head admiringly.
Neat trick. Is it difficult?
Teruenza answered,
not at all. What we find difficult is having to lead the pilgrims in those endless services and prayers. At times, I've been so bored that I nearly fell asleep.
Veritil boomed with his species version of laughter.
Last year, one of the sacredos did fall asleep. He fell right over. The pilgrims were most upset.
Han laughed with them, but inside he was simmering with anger, thinking of the pilgrims staggering down the path, religious faith shining in their eyes. This place makes Garrus Shrike's scams look like nothing, he thought disgustedly. Now that he'd accomplished what he'd come here to do, Han began to think about how to gracefully, metaphorically speaking, extract himself from the mud and the company of the priests. He was rescued by the arrival of a hut, who came gliding over the mudflat on his repulsor lift sled. A small squad of guards trotted alongside, panting in the heat as they struggled to keep up.
Zaval!
Teruenza hailed his hut overlord, standing respectfully. Feeling like a fool, Han did likewise. This was Han's first close-up encounter with a hut, and he tried not to stare at the creature's huge, recumbent form, the enormous pouchy eyes amid the leathery tan skin, and the green slime that oozed from the corners of the being's mouth. The hut leaned toward Teruenza and said in Huttese,
I received a message from home. Zaba and Jiliak deny everything and we have no proof.
Han could just barely make out the meaning of the phrase thanks to his knowledge of Trader's Argot, which included a very meager sprinkling of Huttese. Teruenza replied in Huttese, then continued in Basic.
Zaval, I would like you to meet our brave pilot, Vic Drago, who saved our shipment of Glitterstim.
The huge hut chuckled, a sound so deep and resonant that Han could feel it as well as hear it.
Greetings, Pilot Drago. You have our lasting gratitude.
Han flew many missions for the Elysians during the next 3 months. Several times he was able, with Merg's complicity, to make small side runs to hone his piloting skills and to allow Merg to practice with the weaponry. True to his promise, Teruenza interviewed Bria and gave her the job of maintaining and cataloging his collection. Han was able to see her every day. Once she began getting better food in the mess hall and healthy exposure to fresh air and sunlight, that pale, too thin look vanished, and her eyes grew bright, her step lighter, and her smile came more readily. Bria continued to attend prayer times every morning and devotions every evening. Her loyalty, her spiritual self, was reserved for the one and the all. Still, there was no doubt that she enjoyed Han's company. As Bria climbed to the top of the dune, the wind grabbed her robes and whipped them about her legs. She had to hold on to her cap, lest it be blown off by the ocean wind. Below her, on the beach, she could see Vic, legs braced in a shooter's stance, his blaster in its holster, which he wore slung low, far down his thigh. Merg was some distance away, holding several black ceramic target pieces. Without warning, the big Togorian flung two of the targets into the air, one high and to his left, the other low and to his right. Vic's hand was a blur of motion. A blaster bolt shattered first the right, then the left target piece. Tiny droplets of slagged ceramic rained into the restless Yalician surf. Bria was struck, as she always was, by how good-looking Vic was, with his regular features, brown hair and eyes, and lean build. He wasn't a classically handsome man, but any woman who'd ever been on the receiving end of his smile wouldn't notice that. When he spotted her on the dune, he ran up to her. Before she could fend him off, he dropped a kiss on her forehead. She pushed him away. No, Vic, that's against my vows. I know, but someday, honey, you're gonna kiss me back. Suddenly serious, he looked down into her face. There's something we need to talk about, Bria. I've waited until you were better, because I'm afraid it's gonna be a shock. But you gotta find out sometime. Her heart began to race as Vic took a small device out of his pocket. This is the audio log recorder I pulled out of the dream's control panel. I'm going to play a recording I made a couple of months ago. Vic turned on the recorder. Bria heard Vic greet the priests and heard them invite him to take a mud bath. Then, Bria caught her breath in dismay. She heard Veritil and Terowenza laughing and talking about the exaltation. They were saying it was not a divine gift. They were saying it had nothing at all to do with the one or the all. Bria's eyes narrowed in fury, and she shot to her feet. How could you? I thought you were my friend. Vic came toward her, hands raised placatingly. Bria, sweetheart, I am your friend. I did it for you. You need to know the truth. I'm sorry, you're... Bria's hand and arm seemed to move of their own volition, coming up in a roundhouse slap that connected solidly with his cheek. You're lying. You faked that to make me break my vows. I'm sorry, Bria. Sorrier than I can say, but I didn't fake it. I'm going to prove that to you. Digging into his pocket, he held out a small black vial. Bria knew only too well what it was. Glitterstin? Where did you get it? Light fingered it during a delivery. This is the only way I can prove to you I'm not lying. If you expose it to light, then swallow it, it'll give you temporary telepathic abilities. You'll be able to read my mind, and you'll know that I'm not lying about the exaltation, and that I didn't fake that recording. Here. He dropped it into her hand. Take it. Bria looked down at the tube. I need to think about this, Vic. I need to decide what to do. Vic's words continued to plague her. That evening, when she stood before the altar of promises, and pilgrims were falling to their knees all around her, Bria let herself follow them, but as she did so, she flipped the vial of Glitterstim open. Within seconds, it activated, sparkling blue, but none of the pilgrims noticed. As she mouthed the drug, then swallowed it, the exaltation began. Bria shuddered as though she'd been blaster shot. The effects of the Glitterstim were immediate. Blood rushed through her body like a ship going into hyperspace. Her head pounded. Her mind opened in a way she'd never afterward be able to describe. As the waves of the exaltation took her, she experienced the pleasure of all the other pilgrims in the crowd. Gasping, Bria opened her eyes and stared at Terowenza, forcing herself to narrow her mind to encompass only his. Images, alien images, flooded Bria's mind, stamping themselves indelibly into her consciousness. Terowenza's mind, like that of every sentient, was full of surface trivia, wondering what he'd have for dinner, boredom with the ceremony, thoughts of the new security measures the huts had ordered him to implement, a minor gastrointestinal churn in his middle. There was not a hint of divinity in the high priest's mind. Bria wasn't surprised when Vic fell into step beside her after the devotions. As usual, he took her arm to help support her. This time she leaned against him, grateful for his support. You were right. Forgive me for doubting you. Her teeth began to chatter. I feel so betrayed. I don't have anything left. She began crying. Nothing. Nothing. Of course you do. Vic kissed her cheek gently. You've got us, right? Us? Sure. We're going to be together, sweetheart. We're going to get off this hellish planet, and we're going to be happy. Escape? Vic nodded. You got it. But you need those credits they're paying you to try and get into the academy. How can you give up that? He shrugged. One credit is as good as another. I'll just have to get it out of Tarawenza another way. It took her a minute to realize what Vic was talking about. The collection. You're planning to steal Tarawenza's collection and escape. Vic nodded approvingly. And you're gonna help me, right? She hesitated. Stealing was contrary to everything she'd ever believed in. But Tarawenza's antiquities weren't in a museum where the public could see them. They were being hoarded by a greedy private collector. Bria drew a long, shaky breath. Okay. I'll help you, Vic. She frowned. What about Murg? You told me that he'd given his word to guard you. Vic drew a long breath. That's the Vrelt in the kitchen. I don't know what I'm going to do about him. I really like the big guy, but I'm afraid he'll be loyal to Tarawenza no matter what. What are we going to do? What if we can't get away? Don't worry, honey. Leave that to me. Vic sighed. I'm a better shot than Murg is, and much faster on the draw. I just wish I could convince him to throw in with us. If he did, I'd take him wherever he wanted to go and give him enough credits to continue his search. He told her about Murg's lost mate. Bria drew in her breath, startled. Vic, there was another Tagorian here. I remember seeing one. Oh, 6, maybe 8 months back. Vic shook his head. I'll have to tell Murg. Those priests lie for a living. Bria pleaded. Please, Vic, tell me you didn't mean that about shooting Murg. Vic's voice was grim. I'll take care of him, whatever it takes. If I have to, I'll shoot him. Maybe I can just stun him. Or give him a knock on that thick skull of his. Leave him tied up so the priests won't blame him when we make our getaway. Just out of sight, Murg turned and glided soundlessly through the jungle. The next morning, Han whistled cheerfully as he stepped out of the shower and headed for his clothes. He had no warning. One moment he was walking, the next something had grabbed him and flung him to the floor so hard it knocked the wind out of him. Han managed to focus his eyes. Murg? What's going on? Murg snarled into Han's face.
Pilot planning to escape. Take Bria. Vic planning to steal from Yalician masters. Vic planning to take care of Murg. Now treacherous pilot will die.
No! Han put his hands up in a gesture of appeal. Please, just listen.
Murg listened last night. Murg heard plenty.
The hand started down. Han squeezed his eyes shut and waited for the end. He felt the breeze of the Tagorian swing graze his cheek, his throat, but nothing touched him. Han opened his eyes. Murg was staring down at him, plainly torn. Finally, he grabbed Han by the shoulder, jerked him to his feet, and pushed him in the direction of his clothes.
Get dressed! Murg not want pilot's blood on his claws. We go to tell Tarawenza what pilot and girl are planning. Priest will tell other guards to kill traitors.
Han hastened over to the bunk, began dragging on his clothes. Listen, Murg, I think Mrav is here on Yalicia. I think Tarawenza lied to you. Murg stared at Han, then his blue eyes narrowed.
You would lie to stay alive, Vic.
Yeah, I would, pal, Han said honestly. But I swear to you, I ain't lying about this. Han related what Bria had told him, and then he began hatching a plan. In a couple of days, I've got to deliver a message from Zaval to a hut on Nalhutta. I've never been to Nalhutta, and I don't know the drill there, but Jalas Nevel has. I'm pretty sure Tarawenza will agree to let me and Nevel fly this mission together. I'm going to suggest that you stay here, because there won't be room for you. Han began pacing back and forth as he thought. The priests know you like to hunt, right? So when I get permission to take Nevel with me, you should request to spend a couple of days hunting. You can move fast over rough ground, right? Murg nodded.
Very fast.
Do you think you could make it on foot to Colony 2?
Yes,
Murg sounded positive. Well, it's our best shot. If Mrav is still here on Yalisha, it's a good chance that she's at Colony 2. You go there and scout it out. Find out if she's there.
And rescue her.
Murg leapt to his feet. No, sit down. That would be the worst thing to do. They'd start a planet-wide search for the two of you. Just find her. Then when we make our getaway, you and me will hop over to Colony 2 and break her out of there. That evening, Han went over to Tirawenza's treasure room to find Bria. When she stepped out, his eyes widened.
Hey, you look great.
For the first time since he'd known her, she doffed her bulky tan robes and concealing cap. Instead, she was wearing a simple pale blue tunic and trousers. Although modest in style, they revealed a figure that was slender but definitely female. She grinned. Exalted Tirawenza told me I could dispense with my pilgrim robes while I was working on the collection. He was afraid that I'd catch them on some valuable artifact and knock it off a shelf. You're the prettiest girl on this planet, no kidding. She smiled, then the smile faded. You're apparently not the only one who thinks so. I had the strangest exchange with Gnartos, Tirawenza's majordomo, this morning. He followed me around and asked me why I'd wound up coming to Yalisha to be a pilgrim. Very personal questions. Han leaned forward. So why did you come here? Or do you consider that too personal to tell me, too? She smiled. Of course not, Vic. It seems so long ago. My father encouraged me to have a career, but all Mother could think about was my making a brilliant match. She thought her dreams had come true when I started seeing Dale. Han felt a stab of jealousy, but reminded himself that there had been other girls in his past. We were on the verge of getting engaged when I caught him sneaking around with another girl, so I told him it was over. My mother was furious with me for breaking up with Dale. He came from one of the richest families on Corellia. I felt betrayed and heartbroken. Just about that time, I heard about a revival that was being held by a Yalishan missionary. The Yalishan priest finished his service with just a few seconds of exaltation, and it made me feel so good, like I belonged with those people. So I sold my jewelry, ran away, and caught the next ship for Yalisha. When they were outside, Bria told Han she had decided not to go to the exaltation that night. Then he told her the escape plan he and Murg were working on. Han sighed. I just wish I could figure out a way to break into Tirawenza's living quarters and search the place until I found where he keeps those ship access codes and the security lock codes for the collection. Security codes? Bria frowned and closed her eyes. She drew a deep breath, then began reciting a string of numbers, symbols, and letters. Han grabbed her arm in excitement.
That sounds like it. How'd you get them?
She gave him a tremulous smile. They were in Tirawenza's mind. I'm afraid they're burned into mine along with everything else. I wish I could forget them. Well, don't wish that till we're off this mudhole. 2 days later, a jittery Han and a placid, jealous Nebel stood waiting outside Jiliak the Hutt's audience room in his winter palace. Han paced nervously. Wonder how much longer we'll have to wait.
I already told you we're perfectly safe, the Sulistan replied. A messenger from one hut to another is sacrosanct. While we're delivering Zaval's message and taking back his reply, we cannot be touched.
Jiliak's Rhodian majordomo beckoned to them.
His Supreme Excellency Jiliak, clan leader and protector of the righteous, will see you now.
The huge audience chamber was filled with fawning sycophants of all species, dancing girls and boys, and an orchestra off in one corner. A massive buffet table heaped with food from a dozen worlds in the opposite corner. Jalous Nebel nudged Han, and he nervously stepped forward to present Zaval's gift. Aides opened it to reveal a contraption whose purpose Han could not imagine. But Jiliak exclaimed over the gift,
A combination hookah and snackquarium messengers. Zaval's gift pleases me. Let us hope his message does as well. Activate it, human.
My dear Jiliak, over the past year, our ships have disappeared, and one ship was attacked. We have traced these so-called pirates to Nar Shaddaa. We know that these villainous missions were devised by you and your great-nephew, Jabba. Your enmity wounds us deeply and cuts into our profit margin. Be warned, Jiliak. Many more attacks will meet with swift reprisal upon you and your clan. We have assembled a great fleet which will surely vanquish your paltry forces.
We have?
Han fought wildly. Jilliak's scream of fury made Han and Nebel leap behind the buffet table. The hut lord's tail lashed out in a giant sweep to strike the recording device, sending it flying. Zaval's image vanished.
Messengers, come forth!
Slowly, Han and Nebel crawled around the edge of the table and got shakily to their feet.
Yes, almighty Jilliak,
Nebel quavered. Jilliak's tail lashed as he moved back and forth, raging.
I send you back to that worm-ridden, parasitical infestation who calls himself Zaval. Tell him he has maligned me and my kin. Tell him I alone will decide when he is to die. Do you understand, messengers?
Han had begun to recover his voice. Yes, almighty one. I'll tell him exactly what you said. On the day Vic and Jalas Nebel flew to Nal Hutta, and Murg was hunting for Mrav, Bria had just finished devotions and was heading for the path leading back to her dorm when Gunnar Toss fell into step beside her. The elderly Zissian reached out to grasp her arm, but Bria yanked it away. The Majordomo smiled as he stepped forward, barring her path.
The Exalted One, Tirwenza, wishes to speak with you, Pilgrim 921.
The High Priest peered down at her as she made the proper obeisance.
Pilgrim 921, you have served us faithfully, and I am pleased with you.
Tirwenza indicated the Majordomo.
Gunnar Toss has asked me for your hand in marriage, and I am pleased to grant his request. Stand before me, and I will pronounce the words to make you his wife.
Bria gasped. Then she felt a wash of pleasure engulf her. The sensation was so intense, so warm, so loving, that she might have agreed to anything. But just as she was about to nod like a pliant zombie, Vic's face swam before her eyes. Bria's spine stiffened and her chin came up. She forced herself to keep her eyes modestly downcast. But, Exalted One, I have taken vows of chastity. I cannot marry anyone.
Your piety does you credit, Pilgrim. And yet the One and the All bless fruitful unions just as they bless the celibate state. I am granting you a special dispensation so that you may marry Gunnar Toss and raise your children to be faithful to the One and the All.
Clever old monster, Bria thought. She took a long, deep breath to give herself time to think. Very well, Exalted One. If this is the will of the One and the All, I must bow to it. But, Exalted One, I must follow the customs of my own people before I can be married. I ask for but a day to purify myself and prepare a traditional wedding gown. Bria held her breath as Tirwenza hesitated. Finally, the High Priest must have decided that she wasn't asking for that much.
Very well, Pilgrim 921. Tomorrow evening, before the entire assembly, you and Gunnar Toss shall be joined.
Please, Vic, Bria thought frantically. Hurry back! Having returned to Yulisha after his and Jalas Nebel's trip to Nal Hutta, Han headed for his room, where he was waylaid by Murg. The Togorian had important news.
I found Mrav. Hear what priests tell pilgrims. Pilate will be roused at dawn to fly to Colony 2 and take her and other shipload of pilgrims to space station to meet incoming ship. Ship coming from Kessel, so no time to lose. Must escape now, or Mrav will be gone and made a slave in Kessel mines.
Escape tonight?
Yes.
Okay, okay, pal, calm down. Han tried to think what had to be done. First things first, we'll need some blasters, 5 or 6 of them. You used to live in the guards' barracks. Think you can sneak in and get them? Murg nodded. Yes. If I were you, I'd swipe them from the Gamorreans. They're dumb as a box of rocks, and they sleep like logs. Murg's whiskers
twitched with amusement.
Yes.
The first item on Han's agenda was to knock out the colony's comm units. He didn't want anyone summoning reinforcements. When he reached the comm center, he dug in his pocket for the scrap of flimsy that Bria had given him, containing all of the security codes she'd gained from her foray into Terowenz's mind. With a soft electronic hum, the door swung open. Han grinned as he crept inside. That's my girl. There was a guard stationed there, as Han had known there would be. A Twi'lek, asleep in the chair. Han drew his blaster, changed the setting to stun, and squeezed the trigger. A blue circular burst erupted, enveloping the guard. The Twi'lek jerked once, then collapsed bonelessly into the chair, looking exactly the same, except the snores had stopped. Stepping over to the comm unit, Han pulled out the small multi-tool most pilots carried in their pockets and set to work loosening the casing. His eyes widened at the myriad wires, circuits, transponders, cables, and row after row of identical unlabeled compartments. Han groaned aloud. How am I supposed to know which of these carries the line to the power generators? Selecting a wire at random, he cut it with the multi-tool's small laser torch. The power indicator remained on. Han cut another wire, then another. Stupid board! Han drew his blaster, thumbed it up to full intensity, and discharged it right into the middle of the stubborn console's innards. Flame shot up. The smell of singed insulation tickled his nostrils. Sparks erupted, and the power indicator went out. Han's next step was to find Bria. He knew that her little bunk was on the second floor of the dorm. Han tiptoed up the stairs, blaster set on stun at the ready, but he met no one. He wasn't sure which bunk Bria occupied. Peering through his infrared goggles he had borrowed, he padded quietly down the central aisle, glancing at the sleeping faces in the couches, pallets, and bunks favored by various species. A board creaked beneath his foot, and Han paused, holding his breath. A figure clad in a white nightshirt sat up in a bunk. "Vic?" Bria whispered. Han nodded and beckoned urgently. "Fast!" She pulled her tunic on over the nightshirt, and they made a cautious way down the stairs and out into the blackness of the night. He broke into a run, and she pounded gamely alongside him. Soon, though, her stride shortened, and he could tell that she was fighting a stitch in her side. Slowing to a rapid walk, he towed her along the jungle path. She yielded to his urgent tug and began jogging again. By the time they reached the administration center, Merg was waiting for them outside Turuenza's collection room. At his feet lay a pile of blasters. Bria's eyes widened. "What are those for?" Han was already busy at the door. "Diversion. Okay, now, here's this bypass code." As before, the door opened. Han turned to the other two. "All right, you start packing. I'll be back in about 15 minutes. Han grabbed the blasters and headed out the door. Carrying 6 guns in one's arms, he discovered, wasn't easy. He shoved them into the front of his coverall and into his belt. They impeded his motion somewhat, but that was better than juggling them in his arms. It took him nearly 7 minutes to reach the first Glitterstim factory, and another 2 to creep up close enough to the guard, a huge Gamorrean, to stun the alien at close range. When Han reached the bottom level where Bria had worked, he turned right to where he'd caught a glimpse of the containers of raw Glitterstim waiting to be apportioned to the workers. Yanking 5 blasters out of his belt, Han arranged them atop the Glitterstim and set each powerful weapon to overload. A thin whining filled the air, growing louder in the cavernous space. That ought to do it. Han knew he had only minutes to get out before the whole place exploded. He bolted for the turbo lift. He was halfway back to the administration center when he felt the ground shake and turned to see a gout of yellow flame reaching into the night. Moments later, the blue sparks of Glitterstim fizzled up like fireworks, sending sparkling streamers high into the air. Han could barely guess how many credits he was watching go up in smoke. It was a sobering sight. Guards appeared all over now, shouting and yelling questions, but none stopped or questioned Han. He made it to the door of the collection room, looked both ways, and then slipped inside. Bria and Merg looked up, saw him, then relaxed visibly.
"What did Vic do?" Merg asked.
Han grinned. "Vic blew up the Glitterstim factory. The whole bunch of pilgrims are now out of a job." He reached for a hand-sized sculpture of a Torsk from Alzok III, carved from lapis, and when it proved heavier than he'd realized, yanked hard to pull it toward him. The sculpture tilted up to reveal a snarl of wires and transponders. Next door, in Tirowenza's personal apartments, an alarm began to buzz stridently. Hans stared at the sculpture, then at his fellow thieves. Uh-oh. The doors on either side of the collection room burst open simultaneously. Tirowenza stood framed in the door to his apartment, snorting with rage. Zaval and a squad of guards filled the double doors to the corridor. Han grabbed Bria and dived behind the huge white jade fountain that stood in the middle of the room, while Murg took refuge behind the central support pillar. Zaval shot forward on his repulsor-lit sled.
Get them!
Tirowenza charged like a mad beast, head down, horn ready. Han snapped off a shot, saw the blue stun bolt, and cursed as he thumbed the weapon's intensity up to full. The sunbeam didn't even slow Tirowenza down. Murg aimed, fired, and brought down a Sulistan guard. Han squeezed the trigger again. The blaster bolt ricocheted off Zaval's sled and struck the support pillar nearest the door, burning it half through. The pillar sagged, but held. As Tirowenza headed for Murg, the big Tagorian leaped out and grabbed the high priest, clutching him around the neck and by his horn. The Talanda Till's momentum caused his massive hindquarters to swing around and slam into the middle pillar with a huge thump. The floor quivered and dust sifted downward from the ceiling. Tirowenza's rear feet skidded, and the high priest went down. The ground shook again. Han snapped off a shot and a Gamorrean screamed and fell back into the hallway. Another blaster bolt sizzled past Han, so close that he felt it singe his hair. He dropped to the floor, rolled, and snapped off two more shots at the underside of Zaval's sled. As he'd intended, the blaster bolts hit the housing for the repulsor-less unit. Instead of sinking to the floor, the sled's speed and directional controls went wild. With Zaval vainly trying to control it, the big sled hurtled forward at top speed. Mowing down everything in its path, the sled careened around the collections room with Zaval, a helpless passenger. Then the sled plowed into the room's central pillar. The support column buckled and groaned, then bent in two and snapped off. Then the pillar Han had partially vaporized followed suit. Half of the ceiling bulged, cracked, and plummeted down. Han recovered himself just in time to yank Bria out of the way as a huge chunk of stone hurtled at them from the upper level. Zaval screamed as massive chunks pinned into the shattered remains of his sled. Coughing and gagging, Han crawled off Bria. He stared at the spot where Zaval had been, but all he could see of the buried hut overlord was his spasmodically jerking tail. Tirowenza had thrown himself beneath the protection of a massive antique table and remained relatively unscathed. When the debris stopped falling, he crawled out from under the dust, lowered his head, and charged. Han fired a bolt into his right flank, sending him crashing to the floor with a scream. Come on! Han grabbed Bria and a knapsack of stolen goods and gestured to Murg. We're getting out of here! Slipping in the rubble and stumbling over bodies, the three thieves headed for the double doors where Han motioned his comrades back and cautiously slid his head around the edge of the door, only to be rewarded by a blaster bolt that nearly took his ear off.
Murg, take Bria out the other way. Go through Tirowenza's door and we'll catch them in a crossfire on the count of 50.
The Tagorian nodded and he and Bria slipped back through the ruins of the treasure room. Silently, Han counted. At 15, he stuck his hand around the edge of the door and snapped off four quick shots. He was rewarded with a howl of agony. One more down. He waited, counting and trying not to cough on the dust that filled the air. 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50. Han dived out the door, hit the corridor rolling, and fired. Red blaster bolts zinged past his legs and where his head would have been, but he got another guard. The remaining two guards took to their heels and pounded away from Murg and Bria, leaping over Han's still recumbent body as they did so. Han got to his feet just in time to hear Murg let out a huge battle roar and grapple with... Who? Han couldn't see anyone. Has he gone crazy? Han wondered. Then he heard a loud hiss and glimpsed a reddish-orange eye and a mouth full of teeth. He saw a blaster wave, seemingly in midair, and suddenly he could make out the warty, scaled being. A skin changer. The creature was the exact color of the walls and floor in the dimly lit corridor. Murg growled as he savagely attacked the era. Han winced as Murg fell to his knees, grasping his foe. With a motion like a striking growl viper, the Tagorian buried his fangs in the era's throat and ripped. Blood spurted into the air. "Look out!" Freya yelled, and Han instinctively ducked. Freya's blaster went off in stun mode just over his head, making his ears ring. He straightened up in time to see Gunnar toss slowly crumpling to the floor as a blaster slipped from his fingers. Han walked over to the old major domo and, picking up the blaster, slipped it into his belt. Freya came to stand beside him. "Oh, Vic, all I can think is that if you hadn't come back today, tonight I'd have been his wife." She shuddered. "Huh? Taro Enzo was going to force me to marry him tomorrow." "Well, I'm glad you only stunned him. He may have been a lecherous old creep, but how can I blame him for being attracted to you?" The talisman was a little larger than the Yelician dream, but instead of cargo space, most of its interior was given over to lavish passenger quarters and amenities. It was proportioned and laid out for the Talanda Til, so only the pilot's cabin contained human-style seats. There was one small, human-sized bunk in a guard's cabin. The rest of the passenger cabins were outfitted with the sleeping hammocks the Talanda Til favored. Murg strapped himself in.
"Now from Rav. Right, Vic?"
"Right, pal. We should be there at sunrise. Oh, and by the way, there's something I'd better tell you two."
"What?"
asked Freya and Murg together. "My name's not Vic Drago. My real name is Han Solo. It'd be good if you started calling me that." Colony 2 was on the other side of the Mountains of Faith, set on the northeastern edge of the shallow ocean that enclosed the entire eastern continent. Freya pointed excitedly.
"I see them! There's a big crowd assembling at the altar!"
Carefully, Han brought the talisman in over the amphitheater. He was conscious of all the pilgrims looking up and pointing as he dropped lower and lower with each pass. Han could see several priests and a bevy of guards behind the milling crowd of pilgrims. He knew the Sacredos must be wondering why the High Priest's personal yacht was being used to ferry pilgrims to the Kessel slave ship. Freya went to the rear of the ship to help Murg prepare for his descent by wire and harness. Before long, she called out, "Murg is ready, Han." Han glanced at the belly holocam screen in time to see Murg descending, his blaster still holstered. The cam didn't provide audio, but he watched as Murg's mouth opened and knew he must be calling to Mrav. Two things happened simultaneously. A tall figure in a pilgrim's robe suddenly broke and raced toward Murg's dangling figure, and the guard aimed his blaster. He saw a spurt of blaster fire from the guard's weapon, answered twice in rapid succession by Freya and Murg's blaster fire. Two more guards drew their weapons and fired. The crowd of pilgrims panicked and scattered, trampling each other and the guards. Han fired a burst from the ship's light laser cannon, careful to aim over the heads of the running, screaming crowd. More fire from the guards. Han saw Murg sag in his harness, clutching his side. Mrav reached him a second later and leaped to wrap her arms and legs around her mate, anchoring herself to him. Freya was firing steadily. Han saw a Gamorrean go down. The wire was ascending now, revolving slowly with its off-balance load. Han targeted the Altar of Promises, made sure his aim had pinpoint accuracy, and fired the laser cannon again. The altar went up with a boom Han could hear from inside the talisman. From the nether regions of the ship, he heard Bria's voice.
"I've got them! Let's go!"
Han checked that the bay doors were safely closed, then took the talisman up in a rush. Han glanced at the Tagorian who slid into the co-pilot's seat beside him and started in surprise.
"You're not Murg."
"I am Rav,"
the female Tagorian introduced herself. She doffed her pilgrim's robe and her white and orange striped coat blazed like fire.
"I will handle the weapons for you. In our species, females are better as technicians. Besides, Murg is wounded."
Han felt a stab of concern. "Is he going to be okay?"
he should be. My people are very strong and hardy. Your Bria is with him. He is resting.
Mrav looked up at Han in alarm.
Who shot at us?
Han studied his readouts.
That's what I'm trying to find out. I don't think the priests have surface to air stuff, but I'm hanged if I can see.
Han broke off with a whoop of laughter as the talisman shuddered again. Mrav looked at Han as if he were crazy.
There is someone shooting at us, and they are gaining.
Han waved a dismissive hand. Oh, it's just old Jalus Nebel in the Elysian dream. The priests must have ordered him to come up here and shoot us down. He wouldn't shoot me any more than I'd shoot him. So he's firing his laser cannon, just missing us by a hair each time, making it look good. We're almost clear of the atmosphere, and if Nebel's got a grain of sense, he'll take the dream and get his droopy jowl little carcass off Yalisha, too. Another near hit caused the talisman to shiver. Mrav studied the sensors and called out to him,
I see a vehicle above us, in our path.
Han looked up and swore in six languages.
That's a Corellian Corvette. What's it doing here?
His hands flew over the controls as he began evasive maneuvers, increasing speed and shearing away from the huge vessel. Suddenly, the talisman jerked hard and bucked. Bria burst into the cabin. What's wrong? She demanded. Han began shutting down his engines to avoid burning them out. As he did so, a voice erupted from the comm unit.
Attention, talisman. This is Captain Negin Rios in command of the Helot's Shackle out of Kessel. We advise you to shut down your engines. You are caught in our tractor beam.
I know, Han yelled, not bothering to activate his comm unit. Thanks for telling me.
We have detained you because I have been advised by planetary authorities that you have taken the talisman without authorization.
Bria was staring at the Corellian Corvette. We're being pulled toward it, Han. Han nodded dully. There's nothing I can do, sweetheart. They've got us caught. We can't break free. By now, the talisman had been nearly drawn into the gaping maw of the ship's docking deck. Only a few hundred meters separated the two ships. The Elysian Dream came streaking toward them, moving at terrible speed. Everyone in the talisman's control cabin ducked as the little freighter flashed by overhead, then banked hard to starboard. Jalus Nebel took the Elysian Dream between the talisman and Helot's Shackle at full throttle. The distance was so tight that the little Sulistan had to turn the Dream on her side to make it between the two closing vessels. Go, Nebel! Cried Han. Go! When the Dream rushed between the two ships, it broke the tractor beam for a few precious seconds. Han suddenly released ship, ricocheted away from the Corellian Corvette like a blaster bolt, shearing off to the left, while Jalus Nebel sped away to the right. Yee-haw! Han yelled in sheer exultation as he felt his ship soaring away from the Helot's Shackle. Han grinned at Bria. Say goodbye to paradise, sweetheart. Han awakened to the sound of soft, muffled sobbing. He had been sleeping on the floor in Teruenza's living area, on a pile of expensive carpets he dragged into place. He found Bria in the guards' room, sitting up on the little human-sized bunk, arms around her knees, her face pressed against them. Han went over to her. Hey, what's wrong? What's happened? She began to shudder. It's the exaltation, Han. I woke up and realized that the pilgrims are gathering for devotions right now, and I'll never have it again. Never feel that good again. Han didn't know what to say. He realized that Bria was missing the physical and emotional sensations that accompanied the exaltation, just as an addict would miss a drug. The realization scared him. Would Bria be able to fight this dependency and win? Would she go through life mourning what she'd lost? He spoke cautiously, not wanting to frighten her by voicing his real thoughts. Of course you'll miss it for a day or so, maybe a week, but we'll all help you through it, honey, and then... He made an all-encompassing gesture with his hand. It's a big galaxy, sweetheart, and it's all ours now. The wedding ceremony between Murg and Mrav took place at sunset of their third day on Togoria. Han and Bria stood beside Murg and Mrav as they solemnly faced their assembled clans. Their fur gleamed from hours of careful grooming. First, the betrothed couple faced their clans, turning slowly so that all might see their faces. Then Mrav and Murg turned to face each other. Han blinked in surprise as a low, growling yowl began emanating from their throats. Both bared their teeth and hissed. Their claws sprang out. Then, so quickly that the eye could scarcely follow, they sprang at each other and went down on the ground, teeth locked on each other's throats. Growling, yowling, and snarling, they rolled over and over, slashing at each other with their front paw hands. Their feet were busy, too, digging deep into each other's furred belly. Han looked over at Bria, who was looking faintly alarmed. But no one in the crowd seemed to find anything amiss about what was happening. It takes all kinds to make a galaxy, Han thought. Finally, panting and growling, the two combatants broke apart. Despite the apparent ferocity of their attacks, no blood was visible on their coats. They circled each other, and their yowls gradually died away into soft, gentle noises. They stood close together, rubbing their faces against each other for a long time. Han could hear their hoarse purring from where he was standing. At the end of the wordless ceremony, which Han and Bria found mostly unintelligible, Murg grabbed Mrav by the loose folds of skin at the back of her neck. Clutching her in his teeth and powerful arms, he lifted her and carried her across the circle. The crowd parted before them. Murg vanished into the darkness, still carrying his mate. Moments later, two loud, triumphantly ecstatic yowls broke the stillness, and then silence reigned. The next morning, Bria discovered that Han was waiting outside for her. He stood beside a Mozgoth, a large flying lizard Murg had told him were the principal means of travel on Togoria. Togorians had domesticated the Mozgoths long ago. Both species worked together to protect each other against even larger winged reptiles, the deadly Lifons, who stole both Togorian cubs and Mozgoth eggs. Han held out a hand. Come on! Climb up! With a thrust of the Mozgoth's powerful wings, Han and Bria were airborne and climbing steadily. Bria found herself high above the trees and the tops of buildings. The wind rushed by her face, blowing her hair, bringing tears to her eyes. Oh, Han, this is wonderful. Half an hour later, the broad river they'd been following widened until it branched into a large delta. Han turned the Mozgoth north, and then, within a few more minutes, Bria saw the curling white breakers splashing over silvery gold sand. They spent the whole day at the beach. Bria taught Han how to swim. They shared the provisions he'd brought, and then they walked along the beach for hours, hand in hand. Han grinned at Bria. You look beautiful. She sighed. I feel as though I own the world. This day, I'll remember it always, Han. His head turned, and his lips found her mouth. Bria closed her eyes, and time seemed to stop. She kissed him back, and it was a long, long time before they spoke again. Han set a leisurely course for the Corellian system that took Talisman far from hut space. He was deliberately prolonging his and Bria's time alone together. Inwardly, he was dreading having to go back to Corellia and meet her family. Besides, he was trying to give her as much time as he could to heal. He knew she still pined for the exaltation, though she no longer broke down in panic attacks or fits of sobbing. But several times he'd awakened in the night to find her gone. Why can't I be enough for her? He asked himself. Why isn't our love enough? On Tralis, Han was able to sell the talisman, although for considerably less than he had hoped to get. Later that day, after he had gotten fake IDs made, Janil Andras and his wife, Drea Andras, boarded an inter-system shuttle bound for Corellia. Bria had worried about posing as husband and wife, but Han had assured her that the hut security alert bulletins listed them as being single. The pair arrived on their home world early in the evening and caught a transcontinental shuttle to the southern continent, where the Theron home was located. Bria contacted her family, and moments later, an expensive speeder pulled up outside the station. A handsome, distinguished-looking man with gray hair and a heavy-set build was at the controls. As Han and Bria approached the vehicle, the man leapt out of the speeder and, laughing and crying at the same time, embraced his daughter. Long moments later, he turned to shake Han's hand. "I'm pleased to meet you. I understand from Bria that you saved her from, well, from terrible things. All I can say is thank you. Thank you, Solo, sir. Make it Han." Theron's grip was firm. "Please, call me Ren, Han." The ride to Bria's home was short. They passed through a reinforced set of security gates, then headed down a road that seemed to have no other houses on it. Han saw high fences, the type he used to sneer at back during his days as a burglar. The Theron house was huge. Wings and modified towers and landscaping to match. Before they could reach the front door, Bria's mother came bursting out, dressed in a flowing gown that Han could only recognize as rich. The woman enfolded Bria in her arms. "Darling!" Midway through the whole hubbub of greetings, tears, embraces, and excited questions and answers, Bria's brother came home. Han recalled Bria saying her brother's name was Pavik. He was a handsome youth and seemed genuinely fond of his sister. It was a long time before Bria could disengage herself from her family to introduce Han. Eyes shining, she took his hand and led him over to meet her mother, Sarah Theron, and her brother. Han shook hands and put on his best manners. "Pleased to meet you, Lady Theron, and you, Pavik." Bria's mother's hand clasp was limp and unenthusiastic. She studied Han, and he gained the quick impression that she didn't much like what she saw. He sighed inwardly. "I've got a very bad feeling about this." Refusing to let his discomfort show, Han joined the family in a luxurious parlor where he lounged back against the opulent cushions with a deliberate show of ease. Bria's mother said stiffly, "I gather we have you to thank for Bria's return." Her eyes were fixed on Han's blaster, and he realized that, like most citizens, none of Bria's family went armed. "Tough lady," Han thought. "I don't take off my blaster for you or anybody." "Well, I tried to be helpful, Lady Theron, but I couldn't have managed without Bria. She's plenty tough when she wants to be. Good in a fight." Lady Theron stiffened, and Han realized that the woman would not regard what he'd said as a compliment. Pavik Theron turned to Han. "So, Han, what do you do?" He was staring closely at Han, his eyes assessing in a way that made the pilot uncomfortable. "Oh, whatever it takes to get by. Mostly I'm a pilot." Lady Theron brightened slightly.
"In the Navy? Are you an officer?"
"No, freighters, ma'am. I can fly most anything, anywhere." Ren Theron sat forward and said with a note of approval in his voice, "I started out as a pilot many years ago, when I was about your age, Han. Worked my way up until I owned the shipping company. That's how I made my first million." Han thought of telling Ren Theron that he was intending to enter the Imperial Academy, but the habit of not revealing any personal information was too ingrained. He just smiled at Bria's father. "Those were exciting days, sir. Lots of pirates back then, right?" Ren Theron smiled. "I had a few run-ins. I imagine you have, too." Han smiled back. "A few." Pavik Theron was still staring at Han.
"You look so familiar. I know I've seen you somewhere before. A barbecue, I think? I have a mental picture of you at a barbecue that followed a swoop racing meet."
Han stiffened inwardly. Now that Pavik mentioned it, Han remembered him, too. Pavik was probably 2 or 3 years older than Han and had been a frequent competitor at some of the swoop races Han had competed in. He answered as casually as he could manage, "Sorry, don't remember you. Afraid I ain't been to a Corellian barbecue since I was a kid." The next day, Han left the Theron house shortly after breakfast and headed off to catch the shuttle to the nearest large city. He carried with him the backpack containing the items they had stolen from Terroenza. He disembarked from the shuttle in the port city of Tyrena and went to a locked box office where he retrieved a few hundred credits and a set of clean IDs for one Jaina Sedanian. Then he went off to a branch of the Imperial Bank and opened an account using the credits and ID. Then he went in search of an antiquities and art store he recalled from past escapades. The proprietor was an old man, still spry despite his stooped body, wrinkled face, and wispy yellow-white hair. Galadon Okinor had looked exactly the same when Han first met him. Now he looked up and smiled at Han.
"Well, it's who today, son?"
Han smiled. Dano Sedanian, sir. He genuinely liked the little man, who was, at one and the same time, a respected art assessor and appraiser, and a very competent and trustworthy fence. A little later, Han left the store with a satisfied smile and carefully stowed his Dano Sedanian IDs and the bank record into his credit pouch. He'd travel under different IDs and leave Dano Sedanian clean, only using him for the bank withdrawal he'd need to get into the Imperial Academy on Coruscant. When Han walked through the gates of the Theron estate, he noticed a small, very sporty land speeder hovering in the paved courtyard. He approached the door and found a young man standing in the parlor. Pavic Theron and his mother were there, talking to him. When Sarah Theron saw Han, her face fell. Han pretended not to notice. "Hi, Lady Theron. Is Bria around?" The young man turned to regard Han. He was a good-looking fellow, perhaps a year or so older than Han himself. He smiled and held out his hand. "Hello. I'm Dale LeVar, and you are..." His gaze sharpened, and before Han could speak, he exclaimed, "Wait a minute, I thought you looked familiar. Talus Bryn, right?" Han could think of no curse profound enough. He smiled weakly and shook hands. "Hi, nice to meet you." Pavic Theron frowned. "Talus Bryn? But he's..." Sarah Theron stopped abruptly when her son nudged her, none too gently. Dale LeVar was oblivious to the byplay as he wrung Han's hand. "What an honor this is. I still remember the day you set that record, and you did it by flying through the tunnel on Tabletop Mesa rather than over it. Is this Bria's new suitor? The swoop racing champion of all Corellia? Your record still stands, Bryn." Bria's entrance was a welcome interruption. Han tried to catch her eye and give her a look-sharp high sign, but all her attention was for the newcomer.
"Dale, what are you doing here?"
"Your mother invited me over. You're looking wonderful, Bria. I'm so glad to see you back safely and with such a distinguished escort. I've wanted to shake this man's hand ever since he won the swoop racing championship last year." She looked at her mother. "You invited him over, Mother? How nice." Han didn't miss the edge in her voice. "I get it," Han thought angrily. "Mama here wanted Bria to see me next to her rich guy ex-fiancé, figuring I'd come out looking like some kind of low-life jerk." Bria continued pleasantly. "Well, Dale, it was lovely of you to drop by. Perhaps we can all get together for lunch someday." Dale left, and the rest of them just stood there looking at each other. Han had never heard such a profound silence, even inside a spacesuit in vacuum. He glanced quickly from Bria to Pavic to Sarah. All three were staring at him grimly. Han cleared his throat. "Think I'll take a little walk, get some air." Bria felt like screaming, then sobbing, but she struggled to control herself. They had gone into her mother's dressing room. Her mother was sitting in a pink brocade chair, crying, "We must do something!" Pavic was waving his arms and raising his voice. "You heard him last night. He gave us a fake name. Han Solo, right. Who knows what his real name is?" "Stop it," Bria cried. "Han Solo is his real name." Pavic kept shouting, "Then why is Talus Bryn listed as the swoop racing champion of Corellia last year? And another thing, my memory is starting to come back on this, and Talus Bryn wasn't Solo's only alias. The time I remembered was about 3 years earlier at a barbecue after a swoop race. That time, Solo was Keel Garrus, the son of Venadar Garrus. Remember him? That guy who went around one summer selling shares in that Duraloy asteroid and the whole thing turned out to be bogus?" Sarah Theron gasped. "This is terrible. Perhaps we should do something," Bria cried. "Okay, I admit that in the past he made some mistakes, but he's different now. He's going to enter the Imperial Academy and become an officer. Can't you give him a chance? He's trying to change his life." Pavic shook his head. "That's what he told you, Bria, but guys like that lie for a living. I'm calling security." Pavic's hand was on the comlink when a voice from the doorway stopped him in his tracks. "Don't, Pavic. I forbid it." All of them turned to see Ren Theron standing there.
"But, Dad, you don't know..." Pavic began.
"Yes, I do," Theron said. "And I'm telling you, Pavic, you're not calling security."
"But, Ren..."
Sarah Theron began. Her husband turned to her, his glance scathing. "Sarah, I'm tired of you trying to use our daughter as a pawn to further your social ambitions." Seizing Bria's hand, her father dragged her over to stand before her mother and thrust Bria's hands out before his wife's eyes. Look, Sarah. See these scars? Those people made Bria a slave. She might have died if not for Han. Han Solo is a decent guy. He reminds me of myself when I was his age. There are some incidents in my past I'm not proud of either. He deserves our thanks, not a call to Corsic. Han had walked the entire length of the Theron estate and was on his way back when he saw someone coming down the path toward him. It was Bria, and she carried a good-sized bag slung over her shoulder. Han saw her expression and stopped. What is it? Come on, she said. We're getting out of here. I don't trust Pavik not to call security behind Daddy's back. She reached over and took his hand. Now it's just the two of us again. Han nodded. That's the way I like it, sweetheart. At the space station on Coruscant, the passengers were told they'd be shuttled down to the spaceport in small ships. Han was surprised to discover that there was almost no place on the giant world where the natural ground could be seen or touched.
Only in Monument Plaza, their steward told the assembled passengers who traveled on the liner Radiance. There, citizens may touch the top of the only mountain on the planet that still remains. The remainder is all hidden beneath buildings. Coruscant was a warren of buildings. Skyscrapers, towers, rooftops, and more buildings, all built one upon the other in a giant labyrinthine hodgepodge. Han raised his hand when the steward asked whether there were any questions. You say that the topmost roofs are more than a kilometer above the lowest level streets? What's down there? The Radiance's steward shook his head warningly. The lowest levels never see the sun. They're so far beneath the clean air that they are fetid and damp and have their own weather systems. The alleys are infested with granite slugs, duracrete worms, shadow barnacles, and worst of all, by the degenerate remnants of what once used to be human beings. Han and Bria made their way over to one of the viewports on the station while they were waiting for a surface shuttle down. Bria whispered admiringly, "It's like some beautiful golden gem. All those lighted buildings." Han eyed the planet thoughtfully. Looks like a Coruscant jewel. Must be where the world got its name. They were standing in line, waiting to enter the shuttle, when an official stepped forward and pointed at Han's blaster. Sorry, sir, you'll have to check your weapon. Guns aren't permitted on Coruscant. Grudgingly, Han complied with the order, then boarded the shuttle with Bria. As the shuttle kissed the upper edges of the atmosphere, Han leaned close to Bria. That's a big world. If anything happens and we get separated, I want to set up a meeting place. She nodded. Okay, where? The only address I know, because I memorized the location a long time ago, is a bar called the Glow Spider. That's where I'll be contacting Nisi, the specialist. Han kept his voice very low, but not quite whispering. Whispers drew attention, Han had learned long ago, where low-voiced conversations did not. Bria matched her tone to his. That's the guy who can get people IDs so perfect that even the Imperials can't detect them? Yeah, he hangs out at the Glow Spider, level 132, Mega Block 17, Block 5, Sublock 12. Memorize that perfectly. When they reached the rooftop surface of the planet, it took them several turbolift descents to reach the little hostel where Han had reserved a room with their dwindling funds. Bria threw herself down on the bed and stretched with a tired sigh. When are you going to get our money at the Imperial Bank? I'll go first thing tomorrow morning, Han said. But when Han arrived at the Imperial Bank of Coruscant, he was informed by the manager, one Park Eugen Plonk, that Corsic had put a freeze on the funds, which they suspected had been illegally accrued. In Plonk's office, where Han had been summoned to hear the bad news, the manager smiled blandly. I've signaled for our guard. He should be here any moment. Please, have a seat. Rage filled Han with a strength he didn't know he possessed. Over my dead body. He bounded forward and threw himself over the desk, grabbing the bank manager's writing stylus as he did so. Slamming into the astonished Plonk, Han took him over backward in his chair. In a second, he had the sharp point of the stylus positioned just behind Plonk's chubby pink earlobe. One shove and this slides between your jawbone and your skull, straight into your brain, if you have one. You got a brain, Plonk?
Yes.
Good. Then use it. Now get up and sit back down in your fancy chair. Moving precisely, Plonk did as he'd been told. Han crouched behind Plonk's chair, and now the hand holding the stylus sent the sharp instrument prodding into the man's back. The door lock clicked, and the guard entered. In a second, Han was on his feet, the point of the stylus digging into Plonk's throat.
Tell him!
Don't move, Plonk said desperately. He'll kill me. He's right, Han showed a feral grin. Now you, place your blaster here on Plonk's desk. Slowly, carefully, the guard removed the blaster from his holster, placing it on the black marble. Han reached over and picked it up. Now, under the desk. Han placed the muzzle of the blaster against Plonk's temple, still hugging the man to him. Now we're leaving this bank. We're walking out of here, slow and nice. We're heading for the turbolift. When I get there, I'm going to let you go. They were halfway across the lobby before anyone noticed that something was amiss. A man yelled, another man squawked with fear, and a woman let out a shriek. Han pointed the blaster at the ceiling and pulled the trigger. Flaming debris rained down. Everybody down, he shouted. His command was unnecessary. Every citizen was already cowering on the expensive carpet. Han kept a sharp lookout as he and Plonk walked toward the turbolift, so he spotted the squad of Imperial stormtroopers before they saw him. He backed toward the turbolift, dragging the bank manager with him. A glance at its lights reassured him that the lift was on its way up.
He's getting away,
yelled one of the stormtroopers. Han heard the turbolift doors slide open behind him.
Open fire,
yelled the stormtrooper officer. No, screamed Plonk as the sizzle of blaster bolts filled the air. Han jumped back, smelling burning flesh, dragging Plonk's falling body with him into the turbolift. The high-speed turbolift dropped like a stone. One look at Plonk told Han he was dead. Too bad. He'd have let the man go if those troopers hadn't started trouble. Half an hour later, he was back in their room. He felt overcome by his failure to get his credits to provide a decent place for Bria to stay. She made a brave attempt to pretend she wasn't shocked by the dirt, the smells, and the scuttling insects, but the place was cheap and seemed secure. Han buried his head in his hands. Oh, baby, this is my fault. I should have realized the huts would run an all-system scan on my retinal patterns and that they'd turn up all my aliases. I thought I'd been smart, but I was dumb as a box of rocks. Oh, Bria, can you forgive me? She kissed his forehead and said softly, there's nothing to forgive. If you hadn't done what you did, I'd be in a pleasure house being passed around from one stormtrooper to another. Never forget that, Han. You are a hero. You saved me, and I love you. I love you, too. He looked into her eyes. And I've been thinking, if we can just get off this blasted world, I know we can manage. We can work. We'll make a life. I know we can. He hesitated, then blurted, we could even get married, sweetheart, if you want. He could tell she was profoundly moved by his awkward proposal, but she shook her head. Your dreams, Han. You can't give them up. We've gotten this close. We have to think of something. You're going to be an officer in the Imperial Navy, remember? It was his turn to shake his head. Not anymore, Bria. That's over now. I've got to think of what else I'm going to do with my life. Bria began to cry. Oh, Han, I can't bear to see you so hurt. She laid her head against his chest. Han held her tightly. We're okay for tonight. Tomorrow we gotta do some heavy-duty planning. In the early hours before daylight, on this world where night and day meant very little to anyone who wasn't living a wealthy, top-level existence, Bria Theron sat huddled in the grubby, cramped refresher unit. In her hands was a stylus, and before her was a sheet of flimsy and a large stack of credits. Faintly, from the bedroom, she could hear Han snoring lightly. He was so exhausted he'd never heard her get up and leave, never awakened when she'd returned hours later. Now, gripping the stylus tightly, Bria wiped away her tears, then forced herself to finish the most difficult letter she would ever write. Han knew something was wrong, even before he opened his eyes. There was no sound, none at all. Bria? He called. He took a deep breath and told his wildly hammering heart to calm down. Then he noticed that Bria's duffel was gone. There was a note, written on creased and folded flimsy. Han clutched it. It was nearly a full minute before he could force himself to read.
Dearest Han, you don't deserve for this to happen. And all I can say is, I'm sorry. I love you, but I can't stay.
She'll come back, was Han's first thought, and I've lost her forever, was his second. He stared wildly around the room, feeling as if it might explode if he didn't do something. He grabbed a battered chair, swung it over his head, and sent it crashing full tilt into the door. Then he collapsed onto the bed and just lay there for several minutes, head buried in his arms. The pain came and went in waves. Finally, he dragged himself upright and squinted in the dim light to finish reading the words on the flimsy.
Han, please don't abandon your dream of becoming an officer. Don't be afraid to use the money I left. My father gave it to us freely because he likes you and is grateful to you. Accept his gift, please. We both want you to succeed. I've learned so much from you. How to love, how to be loyal and brave. I've also learned how to find people who will help me change my identity. So don't bother looking for me. I'm going away, and I'm going to beat this addiction. I'm going to overcome this urgent need for the exaltation as it takes my last measure of strength and courage. You've been free all your life, Han. And strong. I envy you for that. I'm going to be free someday, too. And strong. Maybe then, we can meet again. Please know that, now and forever. I love you. Yours, Bria.
Suddenly, he couldn't stand being here, seeing this dreadful little room any longer. Stuffing his few belongings into his small bag, Han distributed handfuls of credit vouchers into his inside pockets. Then he put on his ancient jacket and stuffed the blaster into the front of it. He walked out and kept walking. All day and into the late night he walked, moving like a droid through the unsavory crowds of this area far below ground level. From now on, it's just me, Han Solo, he thought, stopping and peering up at the night sky, barely visible at the top of an air shaft. One star, or was it a space station, winked against the blackness. Han's mental declaration had the conviction of a sworn oath. Nobody else. I don't care about anybody else. Nobody gets close from now on. I don't care how pretty she is, how smart or how sweet. No friend, no lover, nobody is worth this kind of pain. From now on, it's just me. Solo. With one part of his mind, he realized the grim irony of his inadvertent play on words. The last of the youthful softness had vanished from Han's features, and there was a new coldness, a new hardness in his eyes. He walked on into the night, and his boot heel sounded hard against the permacrete, as hard and unrelenting as the shell now sheathing his heart. A week later, Han Solo walked toward the Hall of Admissions of the Imperial Space Academy. The building was a topmost level structure, massive and solidly dignified in design. The light from Coruscant's small white sun made him blink. It had been a long time since he'd seen sunlight, and his eyes were still easily irritated. Having one's retinal patterns altered was possible. Han had had the laser surgery and cell rearrangement, then he'd spent a day in a Bacta tank, healing. He'd then worn a Bacta visor for 3 more days, lying in a little back room at Nisi, the specialist's clinic. He'd put his force in action to good use, though, and had listened to hours of canned history and literature recordings, boning up for the examinations he hoped to begin. Han was under no illusions that the academy testing would prove easy for him. His education had been spotty at best. Nisi the specialist had been worth every credit of his exorbitant fee. Han Solo now existed in the Imperial database, along with his retinal patterns. Han Solo now had IDs that were indistinguishable from those possessed by every loyal citizen of the Empire. For the first time in more than a decade, he was clean. Han Solo was a regular citizen, not a hunted fugitive. He still had Vic Drago's and Jaina Sedanian's IDs buried deep in a credit case, but he was simply waiting for a good chance to dispose of them. As he mounted the stone steps to the Hall of Admissions, Han's strides were sure and confident. He walked up to the human recruiting officer sitting behind the desk and smiled politely. Hello, My name is Han Solo, and I'd like to apply for admission into the Imperial Academy. The clerk did not smile, but he was civil. May I see your identification? Certainly. Han laid it on the desk. This will take a moment. Please take a seat. Han sat, feeling the tension, but telling himself he had nothing to be afraid of. Minutes later, the clerk handed his ID back to him and offered a smile. Everything checks out, Solo. You can begin the application and testing process today. Are you aware that over 50% of the candidates are not accepted, and that 50% of those accepted never complete their course at the academy? Yes, sir, I am. But I'm determined to try. I'm a good pilot. The man's smile was actually genuine for a moment. The Emperor needs good pilots. Very well. Let's get you started. The next week was a calculated nightmare. The first step was a thorough physical, more detailed than any Han had experienced before. Then came the hard part. Day after day, a steadily dwindling group of cadet candidates was ushered into private examination rooms. Each room came equipped with an examination droid who posed the questions to the candidates, recorded their scores, and kept tabulations of their standings. Every day, the candidates practiced piloting in a variety of different situations. Every night he studied and fell asleep to the sounds of cram recordings, droning reams of information as he slumbered. Actually, Han didn't really mind dreaming endlessly about the examinations each night. It beat dreaming of Bria. Finally, the day came when he stood before the vid board and looked for his name on the list of disqualified candidates and failed to find it. Heart pounding, scarcely daring to hope, he went over to look at the other list across the hall, the one labeled Cadets Accepted. Han Solo. There it was, in glowing letters. Han stared at it, unable to think, hardly daring to believe it. That night he treated himself to dinner at one of the posh upper-level restaurants not too far from the Hall of Admissions. Afterwards, still wishing to prolong the day, he leaned against a railing and stared into the cold night sky, thinking, I made it. Han smiled, and then froze as something hard jabbed into the small of his back, the muzzle of a blaster. A voice Han hadn't heard for nearly 5 months said jovially, Hey, Han. Good to see you again. I have to admit, you weren't easy to find. This can't be happening, Han thought. Not now. The genial tones held a chuckle now. Han, why don't you turn around real slow and easy and let's talk face to face. Han turned to see, if he had known he would, Garrus Shrike. Shrike scrutinized him. Well, ain't you handsome, boy? Too bad you can't come back with me to the Luck and let some of the ladies get a look at you. You'd be a real favorite, I'm sure. Han finally found his voice. What do you want, Garrus? Oh, so it's Garrus now, is it? Think you're my equal, do you? The man backhanded Han viciously across the face. When Han started to react, the blaster dug threateningly into his midsection. Silently, the younger man wiped blood from a split lower lip. Well, you're not my equal, and don't you forget it. All you are to me is a pile of credits from the huts for bringing Vic Drago back to them alive. Han tried to stall for time. The huts are looking for me? They're looking for Vic Drago and Jaina Sedanian and all the rest of your aliases, boy. But you're Han Solo now, aren't you? And I'm the only one in the whole galaxy who knew that Han Solo was also Vic Drago and all those others. So when I saw the hut advert, I decided to come out of retirement just for you. Really? You'd do better to pull some kind of scam on Gamor. And I'm afraid, Garrus, that I can't go along with this little scheme of yours. As he spoke, Han had begun lowering his voice little by little. Unconsciously, Shrike leaned forward slightly to hear, just as Han, with a wild scream, leapt straight at him. One arm swept up in a block, sweeping Shrike's arm, and almost at the same moment, Han brought his knee up into the man's groin. As Shrike doubled over with a grunt, Han punched him in the jaw, hard. The captain went down. Han leapt over Shrike's crouched form and bolted for the ramp leading up to the tallest roof. From there, he could hide and catch a horizontal tube or a turbo lift. As Han headed out across the rooftop, still scanning for a turbo lift, a blue bolt shot out of the darkness at his right. The shot had come from the doorway of a turbo lift. Blaster unstun, Han thought, running again, zigzagging frantically. Shrike? How can he have got up here so fast? Another stun beam. As he reached the turbo lift entrance, The door opened and Shrike stood there, silhouetted in the doorway, blaster in hand. Han skidded to a halt on the icy permacrete and reversed direction. Shrike here? Who fired those other shots then? But he was too busy racing across the rooftop to give the question much consideration. Shrike's blaster spat blue-green in the shadows. Stop or I'll fry your ass! Shrike yelled. Han ran faster, harder, only to come to a screeching halt on the edge of a roof where the permacrete dead-ended. Arms windmilling, he threw himself backward and headed the other way. His breath burned his chest as he gasped in the freezing air, dodging into a patch of shadow to escape another sunbolt. The shadow suddenly gave way to complete and utter emptiness as an air shaft dropped away into nothingness. Han was going too fast to stop. With a yell of terror, he leapt as hard as he could and managed to clear the yawning gap. He landed heavily on the other side, fell and rolled over, gasping, wind knocked out. He was getting to his feet again. Just as a sunbeam nicked him, Han's entire right side went numb. The Corellian crashed back to the permacrete with an agonized grunt. Letting himself go limp, he waited, hoping that he'd regain the use of his right side soon. Footsteps approached from his left. Han lay still. Only the white plume of his breath revealed that he still lived. The footsteps paused beside him. Han could see Shrike's form dimly. Then a boot kicked him viciously in his right leg. Han gasped with the pain. You low-life scum. For 2 credits, I'd dump your worthless hide off the edge for what you did. The fact that Han could feel pain in the place where Shrike's heavy boot had struck was good. The stun paralysis was wearing off, but he did not move, only lay limp as Shrike grabbed him by the collar of his jacket and dragged him over the permacrete, bumping and slithering toward the nearest turbolift. When Shrike reached the turbolift, he let go of Han's collar. It was hard to just let himself fall, but Han managed to make it look good without banging his head too hard. Shrike's glittery-eyed countenance, a bruise darkening his jaw, appeared in his field of vision. Shrike laughed. The imps must be real hard up if they'd take a loser like you. He spat, and warm spittle hit Han's face. Han was careful not to react. The turbo lift was very close. The turbo lift doors opened. Shrike looked up just as Han lunged up off the permacrete. The element of surprise served him for a moment. Han managed to knock the blaster out of Shrike's hand, but then Garrus was on him. Iron-hard hands clamped around the younger man's throat. Han's eyes bulged as he hooked a leg behind Shrike's and sent the man over backward. Shrike didn't release his grip, so Han went down with him, and they landed in a kicking, punching sprawl. Han heaved upward, throwing Shrike off him. The man lost his grip and went sprawling backward. Han scrambled for where he'd heard the blaster land, and his fingers found it. Shrike was already up and heading purposefully for the younger man when Han came up onto his knees, the blaster pointed directly at Shrike. Han ostentatiously thumbed the intensity level up to its highest setting. Your turn to freeze, Shrike. Shrike grinned. Come on, Han. You know you ain't gonna shoot me. You can't. I'm like your daddy, almost. He was still moving. Only about 4 meters separated them now. Han tightened his grip on the blaster, but he was horrified to realize the muzzle was wavering. Shrike's voice was low and soothing. Let's go down below and talk about this, Han. I won't hurt you. You got my word on it. Your word? Han laughed. Your word isn't worth spit. I'm hurt. Besides, if you shoot me, boy, you'll never find out about your parents, who they were, why you wound up being dumped into that alley where I found you. Han stared at Shrike. You know who they were? He swallowed and felt searing pain. Tell me, and I may let you live. I'll tell you everything when you give me the blaster, Shrike said. Everything. You have my word. With a wash of red light, a blaster bolt struck Garrus Shrike directly in the chest. The captain threw up his hands, a look of terror and pain contorting his features. He fell backward like a stone, dead before he hit the permacrete. Han stared wildly at his hand. His finger was on the trigger of the blaster, but he hadn't moved it. Had he? The shot, he realized, a second later, had come from behind him. Han whirled, still on his knees, to find himself facing another man. He was human, young, medium-tall, slender-build, darkish hair frosted by moonlight. He held a drawn blaster, and every line of him screamed, Bounty Hunter. Okay, kid, it's over, he said, removing a pair of wrist binders from his belt. Stand up. You're coming with me. I followed Shrike because I knew he'd pick you out for me. Han was still stiff from the paralysis and from disbelief that he was being captured yet again. The bounty hunter gestured with the blaster. Drop your blaster, kid, or I'll stun you right in the head and scramble your brains good. The Hutts want you alive, but they didn't say nothing about in your right mind. Drop it. Shaking, Han dropped the blaster from his nerveless fingers. My leg, right leg, won't take my weight. Shrike kicked me. Yeah, I saw him. Old Shrike always did have a hot temper. Moving forward, he added, now, I'm going to give you a hand up. Don't try... With a demented howl, Han hurled himself headfirst into the bounty hunter's midsection. This man was younger than Shrike, stronger and faster, but Han was fighting like a madman with strength born of utter desperation. The bounty hunter went over backward with a yell of surprise. Han threw himself after him, pummeling the man. Recovering himself, the bounty hunter slammed Han across the temple with the muzzle of his blaster. Blood spurted, ran into Han's left eye, but the Corellian didn't let it slow him down. He clawed his way up the other's body as though it were a jungle vine and head-butted the bounty hunter, slamming his forehead into the man's nose. The blaster dropped from the man's fingers. Han butted the bounty hunter in the face again, ignoring the splitting of his own skin. You're not taking me! The Corellian yelled, slamming his head into the man's face repeatedly. With a yell of terror, the bounty hunter heaved upward with all his strength and sent Han flying. The Corellian hit, tried to roll, and slammed up against the structure that housed the turbolift. The bounty hunter, his face a gory mask from his broken nose and split lips, rushed for Han, murder in his eyes. Han waited until the last possible second, then dodged. As the man went by, Han slammed his full weight into the other's shoulder. The bounty hunter's head impacted with the stone structure with a crack that seemed to echo throughout the icy night. The man jerked, went limp, then slid down the wall to lie motionless on the permacrete. Weaving, biting his lip, and swallowing bile, Han lurched to his feet and stumbled over to the man. Two fingers against his throat assured the Corellian that the bounty hunter was now as dead as Garrus Shrike. Gotta get hold of myself, Han thought dully. Gotta think. Han's breath puffed white as he yanked on the man's boots, pulling them off. Slowly, methodically, he set about stripping the bounty hunter. 5 minutes later, Han stood swaying, dressed now in the bounty hunter's clothing. Grimly, he began putting his own clothes onto the corpse. His worn gray pilot's jumpsuit, his battered lizard skin jacket, his boots. He replaced the bounty hunter's blaster in his holster. Lastly, he took a handful of credits and all of his faked IDs and placed them in the man's inside pocket, sealing the pocket shut. Stumbling and limping, Han went looking for Shrike's blaster. He found it finally and returned to the body. Wincing, he adjusted it to its highest setting, aimed the weapon, then turning his head to the side, he fired directly into the corpse's face. When he forced himself to look, the dead man no longer had a face or eyes or retinas. Han rolled the body to the edge, then, with a hard push, sent the bounty hunter tumbling out into empty air. Han Solo stood alone amid the teeming mass of cadets gathered at the rooftop landing field on Coruscant. The tight collar of his new uniform chafed his neck, but he resisted the urge to tug at it. Doing so might wrinkle it, and Han wanted to look his best. All around him, cadets were being hugged and kissed by their families. Only a few cadets were alone, as he was. Han scanned the crowd and noticed a dark-skinned young man a few meters away who didn't seem to have anybody. And there was a girl with military short hair across the landing field who was also alone. But hey, he thought, I'm here. I made it. The Transport Imperator lay waiting for them on the landing field. Soon, the cadets would be boarding it for their trip to Karita, the Imperial military training world. He gazed at the crowd searchingly and suddenly realized that he'd been hoping to see a certain red-gold head among the well-wishers. Dumb, Solo. Really dumb. You didn't really expect her to show up, did you? She's long gone. No, Han decided. He really hadn't expected Bria to show up, but maybe, deep down, he'd hoped she would. He sighed. Delana had used to quote an old Wookiee proverb at him, something that translated roughly as, "Joy unmixed with sorrow is suspect." An Imperial officer was making his way through the crowd. As he passed Han, the lieutenant paused and looked at him sharply. "Your name, cadet?" Han snapped to attention. "Cadet Han Solo, sir." "You forget how to salute, Cadet Solo?" "No, sir." Han gave the man his best salute. The officer gazed at Han's face. "Cadet Solo, what happened to your face?" For a moment, Han was tempted to say he walked into a door, but he decided that the truth was probably the best answer. "Sir, I got in a fight." "Really? I could never have told," the lieutenant said, a tinge of sarcasm in his voice. "What was the fight about, Cadet Solo?" Han thought fast. "My opponent insulted the Imperial Navy, sir." After all, it was true. The lieutenant raised an eyebrow. "Really, Cadet? That was most unwise of him. Did you give him a good thrashing for his disrespect, Cadet Solo?" "I did, sir. I assure the lieutenant that he will never say anything insulting about the Imperial forces again, sir." "Very good, Cadet Solo." The lieutenant smiled faintly and walked on to the head of the group. Han breathed a long, slow sigh of relief. An amplified voice echoed across the landing field. A non-commissioned officer was standing beside the lieutenant giving orders.
"Imperial cadets, assemble in ranks."
There was general confusion for a second, then the lines of cadets formed into ranks.
"We will board the transports in the road. Go pocket and pick up your feet."
Silence fell. Han was in row 4. He stood as straight as he could, looking neither left nor right, waiting for his orders to move. The martial theme of the Imperial Navy began playing. The non-com barked,
"Row 1, march! Row 2, march! Row 3, march!"
Excitement coursed through Han, singing in his blood. "This is it. What I've waited for all my life."
"Row 4, march!"
Han right-faced smartly and followed the man ahead of him toward the Imperator. As he marched, he allowed himself a faint smile. "Today it begins," he thought. "My real life begins." He imagined Dulana's and Bria's faces. They were smiling too. Han's feet were on the ramp. He took a deep breath. Han Solo felt new, as though he'd just been born. The dark past tumbled off his shoulders, and only the bright future lay ahead. He marched forward eagerly and did not look back. This is David Pitu. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Star Wars, The Paradise Snare, Book 1 of the Han Solo Trilogy by A.C. Crispin. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Lars Howell. Abridgment by Trebby Johnson. The Paradise Snare is a production of Lucasfilm Limited, copyright 1997, all rights reserved. The book, The Paradise Snare, is available wherever Bantam books are sold.